Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Hi, thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. I was saying I had such an incredibly busy weekend and not very much sleep, and I said, maybe I won't open my eyes. And Julene said, as soon as you open the mic, you're going to be wide awake and ready
to
go.
That's right.
And Julene Jordan, welcome back.
Thank you.
What do they used to say? You're cocked, rocked? What was that? What was the thing?
What?
Wait a minute, let me back off now. You're locked.
What?
You're locked, rocked. Ready to...
I think we should move along immediately.
It's our buddy Ted. What does he say?
That's the wrong body part.
I know. And ready to rock. Okay.
I don't know, but he...
No, that's it. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock.
Okay, well, he's not our buddy.
No, I know.
Yeah, so my voice is back. You can still kind of hear a little bit.
Yeah.
It was out. It was done. And it was torture. I didn't speak for 5 days.
Wow.
Except to you a couple of times
when you
told me to be quiet. I mean, in a nice way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, this is the WRIF's phone-in talk show. We've been doing it for a few years here on the Riff. I think it began like in 1970 or something like
Amazing.
That. And this incarnation is with me, Peter Werby, and Julene Jordan. Our phone number for you to call in is 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743.
We like emails as well. Short ones, please, if you'd like us to read them on the air. If they're kind of longer and thoughtful, I'll read them anywhere from tomorrow to the next 3 months. I always wonder. Sometimes I go, let me see. This was March 7th.
I know. I always feel terrible when I do that.
Yeah. And I always wonder. I wonder what people think out of the blue.
What is this? Oh, yeah. Like Werby has a, I mean, what's he been doing?
Yeah. Are they thinking? Yeah. The guy's so stuck up. I send him a thoughtful email and he doesn't.
He's too big for us minions.
No.
Never.
We have a Facebook page, which we would like you to like. It's facebook.com/nightcall. Lots of good stuff going on, including you can find information about the show, photographs of me and Julene. You know, other websites have photographs of other people as well. Is it just this vanity?
We're so egocentric.
Here we are. Well, we're in show business.
No, people always ask me. They want pictures of us. They like to see when we're out doing our protest thing and whatever else.
We did a little while ago. We had those photographs of us cooking.
Yes.
But there's so much else that we do. We ought to get some of those
up
on the site as well. And manning and womaning the phones at 313-298-WRIF.
Sarah and John,
yeah. And Athena off this evening. Well, were we speaking of Detroit? Speaking of Detroit.
We were.
Yeah. My niece came in town and my sister's daughter.
Yeah.
And so we said, my wife and I, let's show her around. And like, she said, I want to move here.
Well, because it is a cool town, man.
And she pays for a not very big apartment in Brooklyn, $1,000 a month, her share of it.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, you could own a house in about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah,
Detroit.
Right, exactly. Sadly.
Yeah, a friend of mine, and it's not just Detroit, a friend of mine just bought a house in Hazel Park for $9,000.
Are you kidding me?
Major fixer-upper.
Yeah.
I don't even want to tell you what our houses are worth now.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a big old drag.
Bug, 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 bug,
yeah,
bug,
yeah.
Which is underwater.
We're not going anywhere.
Well, a couple of things that I did. I hosted the Citizens Environment Alliance annual Detroit River Cruise. So we left from Windsor.
Which I still haven't gone on.
Oh, it was fabulous. Great food. And we have these folks talking about, as I always call it, the good, the bad, and the ugly about the Detroit River. And there's a lot of real improvements.
What's the good? I want to know.
The good, they've stopped a lot of dumping. They've begun to clean up in cooperation with, of all these people. They're all were impressive, but John Hardick, who's the manager of the Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge, which is there, he was, just telling what they've done to bring some of these corporations, I was going to say kicking and screaming, but, the clean up the mess they've made over the years. I don't even want to begin to tell you what, the amount of gunk that they dumped on these big islands when you get, there's United States Steel, there's the Zug Island, Fort Rouge.
Right.
I mean, it's, they have whole, huge piles of coal just sitting really? Out there, which means when the wind blows, it blows all this coal dust into the river.
Dirty, dirty.
Yeah, Dr. Linda Corkum was just talking about fishing. And, she's a professor at the University of Windsor, but she had this 400-page book. You know, you ever seen bird books where they identify? Yeah. Well, it was like that, and it was like perfect for the angler, for the, you know, the fisher.
So is it safe to fish and eat out of the Detroit River?
Well, she said you don't want fatty fish. That's where the real contaminants are,
the
fat.
Yeah, because it sits in the fat,
yeah.
Right?
So in her book, let me see if she has a website. She doesn't. But she wrote a book called Fishing. This sounds so boring. I'm sorry, Linda, if you're listening. Fishes of Essex County and Surrounding Water.
Well, I mean, how can that even be made to be sexy?
So, yeah, you can't. Yeah, but she was a great speaker. Also, and Kevin Camps, who I've interviewed before, he works with Beyond Nuclear, and that was the really ugly part of it. I mean, the idea that we are generating this enormous amount of radioactive waste at Fermi 2, and they want to build a Fermi 3, these insane people. Yeah. Davis Bessie down by Toledo, and I mean they're around Michigan, and all they're doing is piling up this nuclear waste. There's nowhere to put it. Some of them are like
it's not going anywhere. Yeah. I mean, it's
like the Fukushima. Some of them are exactly like the Fukushima reactors, and I mean, it's terrible. They should all be just shut down tomorrow. Then also there was the Concert of Colors. This free concert at Orchestra Hall, put together in conjunction with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, that has this range of music from the Detroit Symphony Orchestra to tonight George Clinton and the Funkadelics.
I saw that.
Yeah,
I wasn't there. I saw that.
Were show prepping. We saw this band, but my niece. This is right. She's. I got to move here. Although the band wasn't from Detroit, it was called Black Mahal, and man came out, I can't really describe it, but sort of traditional Indian, East Indian, dress with a white beard and kind of this, well, I won't use my hands because you folks out there can't see it, but with like a twirled up mustache and sort of a turban, but a headdress.
Right.
And baggy pants, and he's playing these drums, and then the whole band came, and they had a, DJ scratching,
Scratching, yeah, sure. Pretty good for a white guy.
Yeah, who needs all that machinery when you get Peter for half the price?
Right.
And so altogether, there was 9 people in the band, and the people that were putting it together, including, our buddy Ishmael Ahmed from Access, he was telling me they like flew in, did this show, and then they had to fly back tonight to San Francisco.
Okay.
And to do another show. And he said, I shouldn't talk about school. What they were being paid wasn't very much. And I kind of looked a little, And he said, but they're all Silicon Valley executives.
Oh, so they can afford.
And they were younger, they were, some of them looked like in their 20s. But
Silicon Valley executives who still have money.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But it's not all.
Sounds good.
And Detroit was just alive. One of the things that my niece loved about the city was, the cultural and racial diversity.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. And she said, you go to stuff.
That's one of the things I love too.
Yeah. You go to stuff in New York, like the stuff she goes to, it's like all white people. Then they'll have all black people somewhere else and all Puerto Rican people somewhere else and all Dominicans.
Segmented. Yeah. They're not together like it is here. And that's the one thing that struck me when I moved to this wonderful city 14 years ago was that, because I'm from Des Moines, white bread, Iowa. Okay. and I always craved that diversity. And when I got here, I celebrated it and I continue to do so. I love it.
Well, here though, we're making this nice idyllic picture. Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, we have issues and that's why we're here.
I forgot then too. We went, today we went to the Detroit Institute of Art. To see, what was it called? I think the official name of it was Detroit Industry, the Diego Rivera murals.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, the Art Institute, the Detroit Institute of Arts is maybe foreign country to some people, but it's worth a trip down there. I mean,
even for that.
Just for that, yeah. Patti Smith right now.
She's got a photography exhibit
That's pretty incredible. And if you want to go look at the old masters, they're there.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And,
there's also a wonderful contemporary wing as well.
Yeah. And the Rivera mural, the Diego Rivera mural, Detroit Industry is in the Rivera Court, as it's called, and it's on four walls, and it's this huge mural of what Rivera did in, I think, like 1932, 1933, of the Ford Rouge.
Yeah, and based on the auto plant.
Yeah, yes, thank you. Right, everybody won't know that. The Ford Rouge auto plant, indeed. And it's just striking beyond belief. My niece said, have you seen this before? And I said, well, maybe about 250 times. For one thing, the Detroit Institute of Arts has a Friday night program where they do everything from, again, like other venues.
Diverse music.
Diverse music from classical to rock to country to, you know, you name it.
Yep.
And so they're in there. But when I was a kid, my parents used to take me to see it. So it's a real Detroit gem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the good news.
Yeah.
The bad news ain't good. Here, this one, New Detroit. I mean, this is absolutely incredible. All right, let's, you know, as I always say, let's take this within the context that we know. This is the absolute wealthiest country in the world. The most amount of wealth in this country, in the world, exists here in the United States. Yet we have three cities in California filing for bankruptcy this week. Scranton, Pennsylvania, where everybody got knocked down to minimum wage, including first responders, police, and fire. In fact, one of them, somewhere or other, do I have that real close? I guess not. Where one of the firefighters said that the kid at he's a 10-year veteran, the fire department.
Here it says, the teenagers who work at the ice cream stand not far from my house, they make $8.50 an hour. That's $1.25 more than I now make. A 10-year veteran firefighter who is the president of Scranton Local of the Firefighters Union.
Now, I know some of you who belong to the largest political party in the United States, the party of resentment.
The party of no?
I think, no, not even the Republicans, just the general party, just resent other people. But I know there's not a sensible person that resents the official duties of the police or what the fire fire department does and how key they are, obviously.
Yeah.
And yet, what's going on here? I mean, why are we in the wealthiest country? Anybody want to kind of put that forth at 313-298-WRIF? Why in the wealthiest country in the world do you have firefighters being forced to work for the minimum wage? In Detroit, New Detroit Schools contract, this was enforced on the school unions, allows up to 61 students in grades 6 through 12.
Per classroom.
Per classroom.
Is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I about fell off of my chair when I read that. I was a substitute teacher in the Ferndale school system. And, you know, there were 30 of those.
That's too many.
Little boogers running around.
Yeah.
And honestly, when I got done with a day of doing that, I had to lay down.
That's incredible. I don't know what the
61?
Suggested level. Yeah, it should be about 15 to 18,
people
something
are crazy.
Like that. The education is so bad in Highland Park, and folks listening from far away should know that Highland Park is a little suburb, broke also, that is surrounded by Detroit.
And also, they've had to shut their streetlights off at night, which there's already a certain amount of crime in Highland Park. And now that's just escalated. People can't even have streetlights.
Comparing conditions in Highland Park schools to segregation in the Deep South and South. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, the ACLU of Michigan filed a class action lawsuit Thursday against the district and the state. The group says both failed to ensure students are reading at grade level as mandated by state law and the U.S. Constitution. Three quarters of the students lack basic literary skills to meet grade level, according to the lawsuit. Mark Rosenbaum, a University of Michigan Law School professor and ACLU cooperating attorney, called the situation severe and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And Carrie Moss, executive director of ACLU of Michigan. Do you have that story right in front of you? I don't know if you read these sentences that kids had written and they used as example. These children, she said, or I guess this was the lawyer, these children have no educational opportunities, and it's as if they were living in an impoverished third world country.
Right here in the U.S.
So what's up with this, folks? I mean, we have the wealthiest country in the world, and school systems are failing to teach our children to read. Detroit Financial Board has enforced these cuts to union contracts in the city. They're going to lay off 2,600 people. That would be great for the economy of Detroit. And they've got to save $102 million. Remember, too, Timothy Cook, the CEO of Apple, made $378 million last year. So he could just dig $100 million out of his pocket.
And save it. Save it all.
Yeah, and then he would still have $276 million.
Still be rolling in it.
Here's the thing, though. You know, like...
But usually there's some certain amount of greed goes along with this, you know, right?
My niece and her companion, who was in also, a couple times said to me, is this a safe neighborhood to go to where we... Oh, yeah, I forgot the other thing we went to, Detroit's incredible Heidelberg Project.
Yeah, I love it.
And if you don't know what that is, just Google it or go there.
It's worth it.
Yeah. How do you spell Heidelberg? H-E-I-D-E-L-B-E-R-G. Thank you. Heidelberg Project. This is an international art installation that's on the east side of Detroit. And it's hard to describe. I mean, it's somebody that took the junk of the world and created art installation out of these entire blocks over there.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, done by Tyree Guyton. And I, when I was there, I ran into Tyree's sisters, and I said, is Tyree around? He said, no, he's still in Switzerland. He was actually given residency, as a, kind of like a visiting, he's not a professor, but it's sort of like a visiting artist.
Really?
What do they call it? Artist in residence.
Sure.
In Switzerland for a year.
I wonder if he's doing a Heidelberg over there.
That could be. And he's really into polka dots, so there's polka dots everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's a whole area that is nothing but vacuum cleaners and a whole boat full of teddy bears and shoes and, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you might be saying, what?
You just have to see it.
Sounds like a junkyard. It sounds like Salvation Army.
It's turning junk into art, which is a very beautiful thing.
By the way, on another beautiful thing about Detroit is the Detroit Riverwalk.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And
I was down there Friday night.
Oh, yeah, for the...
For a little concert series.
Yeah. Right. And you can see some of Tyree Guyton's work they have displayed out there on the Riverwalk as well. Okay, that's the good news. How about this one?
Oh, no, we're back to the bad, right?
Yeah. Persistent violence fosters fear, frustration in Detroit. Listen to this. Customers interrupted during late-night meals at Olympia Coney Island grabbed for towels and tried in vain to save a man who was carjacked and fatally shot in the parking lot. They tried to help set a man who identified himself as Leo, the restaurant owner who wouldn't give his last name because of fear of reprisals. They tried to slow down the bleeding. The man whose identity has not been released was killed around 4 a.m. in the Coney Island's parking lot at Harper and Chalmers. The suspects drove off in the man's Range Rover. It's the latest example of violence in the city's that's already had more than 160 murders this year. Yeah, I remember in the 80s, I think we hit almost 600 murders. So this is not that. Yeah, but most places, the murder rate, like New York City's, keeps dropping. It says criminals have become more brazen. While a Detroit news reporter was interviewing customers at the restaurant about the carjacking, a police cruiser pulled up to investigate a robbery at the beauty supply shop next door. Detroit Police Sergeant Ron Gibson said at least four unarmed women entered Kim's Eden around 11:45 a.m., jostled the clerk, and made off with various hair products. No one was injured. The persistent crime and violence has some Detroiters resigned to a mixture of fear and frustration. And here, and that's what the headline comes from, here is the most damning quote I about our country than I've read in a long time. Reginald Reynolds said, there is no one to help us as citizens. We have no help other than ourselves. There's no hope. The city is going down at a rapid pace. As citizens, we are doomed. Hmm. We are all walking prey here in the city of Detroit. We are our own genocide. It's a process of eliminating ourselves. How would you like to live with that attitude?
I mean, with that fear.
When you come from the suburbs, even the near suburbs, like Jalene and I do, and see Detroit as what we said, the Concert of Colors, the Heidelberg Project, the Detroit Riverwalk, the restaurants, the burgeoning art scene around Wayne State University, all of that, you go, oh, you know, the Russell. We also went to the Russell Industrial Center today. There's a big bazaar there. you think, wow, you know. But there's a sector of Detroit that's divorced from all of this, the poorest sector.
Right.
That, and what also that engenders, people begin innovating in ways to earn income. And if that means carjacking neighbors, you do it. If it means breaking into their house, fine. Right. If it means sticking them up, fine.
Crime comes from desperation.
You know, sociologists always are trying to figure out the root of crime. Well, I mean,
this is a big one right there.
Woody Guthrie in his song Pretty Boy Floyd, the outlaw from the 1930s, he's got a wonderful line in there. He said, some men will rob you with a six-gun, others with a fountain pen. Well, the ones that rob you with a fountain pen, they live out in the wealthy white suburbs, right? And perhaps then violent crime doesn't get too much expression in wealthy and even in middle class areas.
It's always a shock when it happens.
Yeah. Right. It's expected in the poorer areas, and it's all about social class. It's nothing to do with race. I mean, you can go to poor areas and
Indonesia. A lot of people like to say it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you have African Americans disproportionately represented in violent crime in this country, it's a factor, again, of class, not of something motivated by race. I mean, how could skin pigmentation be a driver in all this? If you go
That's like homosexuality not being genetic.
Okay, I'm going to think about that one. if you go to European cities, that are predominant. Well, with an increase of poor immigrants, it's often the immigrants that do it. Before there was that, then it was just all white people. They're all, the white Europeans. It was the poor Italians, the poor French, the poor English, and what have you. You go, obviously, to other countries in Asia, Latin America, and the crime is where? It's not in the upscale district. It's in the poor districts. It goes with the territory. It's crime is one of the definitions of poverty. And you can do a lot of things, enormously increased, police presence. In some areas you have police, other countries patrolling in groups of six. You can wall off your area with, razor wire on your walls.
I've seen it in Mexico.
Or what they do is they put broken shards of glass.
Yeah, I went to a family's house in Mexico, and they had that.
With the glass?
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
The glass and the barbed wire.
Well, it almost, because it doesn't, hello, throw a blanket over it, right?
Well, those shards of glass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Well, but where's it all really rooted? And, I mean, in general, it's right here. The spreading scourge of corporate corruption. That's the name of an article.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it perhaps the most surprising aspect of the LIBOR scandal? We all know about the LIBOR scandal, right?
No, I don't think we do.
That's the London Interbank Offered Rate.
Yes.
Crickets. Can we get the crickets going?
God.
Our lives are pretty simple. And
we all have problems.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's simple in that we're not involved in, 99% of us. Hey, that's a good figure.
That is
99% of us are involved in pretty simple pursuits. And that is, working and getting a paycheck, maybe a few of us hiring people that, not really great, not really big wages, small business owners.
Mm-hmm.
Cleaners or some drugstore or something like that. And if you make a profit, you spend it. If you get a paycheck, you spend what you can. And if you're really lucky, you can save a little and what have you. But when you're dealing with the London Interbank Offered Rate, this ultimately is what is key to our financial situation. I want a better word than that.
Pretty much in... It's one of the most important rates in the economy is what it says in this article.
Let me see. Maybe I can just get it here. It says, for sure, some of the world's leading banks try to manipulate one of the most important interest rates in contemporary finance. And they say that's clearly egregious. In other words, bad. But is it that worse than packaging billions of dollars worth of dubious mortgages into a bond and have it stamped with AAA rating to sell to some dupe down the road while betting against it? Now, again, you may or may not understand all of this, and I want to, to try to explain it to the best I can, because I don't even fully understand it. I'm capable of it, but, I almost like to have this sort of studied somewhat ignorance, because what I was saying, if something is this complex, that it takes these, you know, these financiers, these the carrying out these machinations that are so complex, so involved, so detailed that only a few experts can use it in order to steal.
Right. I was going to say the only people who really understand it are the ones who are corrupting.
Yeah. Right. And you know how much more I would be ahead of the game if I could explain all these derivatives and...
You have somewhat of a grasp of this stuff.
And yeah, and bundled mortgages. But the real thing is to sell to some, and here's the word, dupe, down the road while betting against it. I mean, they were betting that this was going to fail after convincing these people that these had AAA rating. I mean, why aren't these banksters in jail?
Right. Crooks. Really. Yeah. You know, haul them off.
Or Eduardo Porter in the New York Times says, or how about forging documents on an industrial scale to foreclose fraudulently on countless homeowners? Why aren't these people in jail?
Yep.
Says the misconduct of the financial industry no longer surprises most Americans. Only about 1 in 5 has much trust in banks. Could anybody from the 20% please call?
Yeah, who's the one?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Where are we here? Yeah. It's not, and that's about half the level of 2007. It's not just the banks that are frowned upon. Trust in big business overall is declining. 62% of Americans believe corruption is widespread across corporate America. Can you say Bain Capital?
Yes, absolutely.
Right? According to Transparency International, an anti-corruption watchdog, nearly 3 in 4 Americans believe that corruption has increased over the last 3 years.
Well, because it has,
I'm in the 25%.
Oh yeah, okay.
But I think it's as corrupt as it's always been.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. People are paying more attention. I'm not sure
exactly
why now. I think it's all because people are paying attention because of President Obama, and they want to be able to bitch about him, even though we have plenty to bitch about.
I think a lot of it too.
And there's a lot of racism going on out there.
The Occupy movement.
Yeah, yeah.
That brought attention to the 1%.
It did, you're right.
And this writer, Eduardo Porter, says, we should be alarmed that corporate wrongdoing has come to be seen as such a routine occurrence.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you caught all this too as well, but J.P. Morgan Chase disclosed on Friday that its losses on its botched credit bet could climb to more than $7 billion and that the bank's traders have been intentionally, and that may have intentionally tried to obscure the full extent of the red ink on the disastrous trade.
What a shocker, because when they announced that it was $2 billion back in May,
right,
now it's climbed to $7 billion. Oh, shocker.
So what do you think has happened to J.P. Morgan Chase? I mean, besides nothing.
Wait, nothing, and they are rolling in it?
Yeah, their stock has gone up.
Yeah.
That's right. And they're showing a massive profit. It's like $7 billion. Hey!
Hey, you know? That was yesterday.
Yeah. And Detroit needs, a couple hundred mil to make it...
to make it even
so this
a
is,
little right.
Yeah. And there is also... Let me see if this is a... No, this is just what they call an op-ed piece. Rigged rates, rigged markets. Now, I would think... I mean, you're not going to find any conservative, let alone a libertarian, that is going to say, oh, that's okay, because, you know, what they claim allegiance to is the so-called free market. But this is what happens in the free market. And I said a few weeks ago, if we could trust the people that rose to the top of these pyramids in finance, for instance, and in government, without regulation, if they treated us like family, if they treated us, in terms of our full humanity, we wouldn't need this regulation on them. But if you can imagine that Mitt Romney and the Republicans want to peel back regulations on these bandits,
shudder,
these gangsters, these banksters, these racketeers, I mean, this is absolutely amazing. And let me tell you that I think particularly among the libertarians, they would say that obviously if you're rigging rates, that you have a rigged market, and this is not the free market. This is the result of free market, unregulated markets, because greed overwhelms people. The sense of decency is not even present. The idea of allegiance to fairness or a connection with a community is absolutely gone. It is the rule of money, and it is the rule of the masters of money that have to be brought to heel with the most incredibly intricate regulation. And the job killers, it's these guys. They're making out like the bandits they are. They couldn't care less whether you have a job. They're doing just fine with everything as it is. That's why they're conservatives. They want to conserve the status quo.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall.
Be our friend.
Likes liked. Does that make sense? Likes.
We like likes.
Yeah, I want to get to my calls in our calls in just a minute. Michael from Fenton wants to talk about the prosecution of George Bush. I actually have something to say about this. Sue in Harrison Township, talking about the Detroit emergency manager. Mm-hmm. And David from Detroit wants to know how I can say we're the richest nation in the world if we're trillions of dollars in debt. It's a good question.
Good question.
So let's, and there's room for you as well. At 313-298-WRIF. And that's what we were asking. I mean, why do we have so many problems in this country if we are the wealthiest country in the world? Now, at 1 a.m., I'm going to be featuring an interview with Steffi. What an interesting
name. Woolhandler.
Isn't that
it is.
Woolhandler, yeah. And she's a co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. And she is critical of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
Because I can guess why, because it didn't go far enough.
Doesn't go far enough. And I do not understand why the Republicans are opposed to this, because it is...
Because it could be a lot worse in their eyes.
Well, it is the same health policies that Richard Nixon proposed.
Amazing.
Trying to head off socialized
that
medicine.
That's such a good point.
The Heritage Foundation, a far right wing so-called think tank, an oxymoron, I would say, but they proposed this. Republicans proposed this at the beginning of the Clinton term as a health care for all. And the Democrats said, we don't want this because it institutionalizes the private health care system, which spends so much incredible money in
or incredible amounts of money.
Yeah, amounts of money. What's the difference between?
Well, there's incredible money and an incredible amount of money. Because it could be a good thing. That's incredible money.
Oh, I got you. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. Because each year, the industry, I mean, they literally siphon off hundreds of billions of dollars of healthcare dollars for overhead, for profit, for things like paperwork. And they have all these demands on doctors and hospitals. And it denies care in order to ensure their bottom line. It obstructs any serious effort to control costs. Although there is a penalty for insurance companies that are gouging.
It's about time, well, when it happens officially.
So one of the things that I asked Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, who's my guest at 1 a.m. here, on WRIF, is explain what this is all about. What's going to happen on January 1st, 2014, to people now that are eligible for health care? In fact, are now required by the individual mandate and are going to get all sorts of subsidies if depending upon your income. And I got to tell you, I'm still not quite sure what's going to go on. And so
I don't think anyone is.
Well, somebody should be.
Well, that would be comforting.
They're going to have these, if these states get on board, which now these Republicans say that they're not. By the way, you know, this is going to provide health care for tens of millions of people, and it's really got these good things already.
Yeah.
And also, by 2014, that companies are not going to be able, insurance companies are not going to be able to refuse
care?
Insurance to people who have pre-existing conditions.
Well, and that's
now
huge.
It's with kids. Now, but by 2014, it's going to be adults as well. So I'm interested if what your take on all this is and how it would affect you.
And isn't that the humane thing to do anyway?
Yeah, well, you know what?
But they don't have a heart. It's all about money.
The Physicians for a National Health Program, you, me, we think we ought to just have real easy Medicare for all.
Bring it on. Bring
it's okay.
It.
It's okay for grandma and grandpa. Why isn't it good for the rest of us?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would be the model, just like Obamacare modeled Romney Care.
Yes, it yeah. did.
I mean, essentially, the Affordable Care Act is exactly what Mitt Romney put into place in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and how he is getting around that whole thing. And it's truly amazing. These politicians are something else.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Michael in Fenton. Michael, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, we love you, Peter and Jalene.
Wow.
Oh, wow, thank you.
Got the whole
you.
Family out there. Hi.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for being so patient.
Yeah, we really missed you last week. Anybody with a name like Jalene would probably have to be from Des Moines, Iowa.
What does that mean?
Why is that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was a kind of got a, like a two-part thing. You there?
Yeah, yeah, we're here. Listening. Yeah, we you were
we're
you
not
were,
talking
you
all
were,
over you.
It's, yeah, you were talking, so we didn't talk.
All right. Well, that's good. We so I wanted to have sort of like a two-part question about George Bush. Do you think there is any way that George Bush and his father will get prosecuted for the stuff that they have done? And if so, would they execute George Bush? And also, I heard that the Ford family was in on helping Hitler gear up for World War II. Is there any truth to that?
Well, okay, first of all,
no. For
no,
the, no. And yes.
What?
Hitler.
Wait, no. There was a second part that yeah. was about would he be executed.
Well,
it's just a no on the two
yeah,
part.
Yeah. Hitler was a big contributor to the German Nazi Party in the early 1920s. Hitler.
You said Hitler was.
What?
Ford was.
Ford was a big. Ford was a big contributor to because he was this out of control anti-Semite.
Yeah, and Hitler had a picture of. His granddaddy,
Henry Ford,
in his bunker.
Yeah, when yeah, at the end, and Hitler credited Ford with saving the Nazi Party when he got sent to jail, like in 1923 or something like that, and he wrote Mein Kampf in jail, and also Henry Ford in 1938, right before the war in Europe began, right before Hitler invaded Poland and all that. Henry Ford received an Iron Cross from at the German consulate in Detroit from a representative of the Nazi government. This was after what they called Kristallnacht, when this assault began on Jewish institutions and businesses all over Germany. So yeah, no, he.
You are correct.
You may have heard David Rovics on this program, and he has a song called "Henry Ford Was a Fascist."
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Michael.
And, yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. By the way, and Sue and David, I'll get right to you. The International Criminal Court has issued its first sentence. Now, some people say that's where George Bush and Dick Cheney and Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld mm-hmm. belong for their lies about the Iraq war.
And Condi should be in there, too.
Let's get Condi. Yeah. Yeah. We'll get her in as well. But the International Criminal Court in The Hague sentenced a Congolese warlord to 14 years in prison on Tuesday for using child soldiers in his rebel army in 2002 and 2003. This Joseph Kony, the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, which, you know, abducted children, turned them into soldiers, and committed all these atrocities. And I remember that was that big sort of flash in the pan in a way that the kids had all these little bracelets watching this video online. Remember that? And that was the guy.
That was the big Facebook thing about Kony.
Yeah.
And it's so funny how.
Kony 2012.
How these things happen.
And the
know?
Director turned out to be this born again Christian, and then yeah. they caught him running naked through the streets of Los Angeles. Not Kony, but the born again Christian.
Yeah. And that whole thing, I would say to people, listen, you know, this, you need to really look into this and what it is. I mean, yeah, the guy was.
I don't want to just keep dragging all this stuff up about Iraq, but George Bush, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and the rest of them knew there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, how do they know? I knew that. Jalene knew that.
We knew that. We said it right away, and we said to all the doubters, listen, you will be calling us in a few years and saying, you know what, Pete, you know what, Julene, you guys were right.
So all this death, all this destruction was based on these purposeful, calculated lies by the Bush administration, and that's who belongs in the International Criminal Court in The Hague, maybe alongside this Congolese warrior. And Henry Kissinger, his crimes in Indochina, I mean, this guy can't even travel around the world or he's going to be arrested because there are these international warrants out for him. The overthrow of the Chilean government, God, now it's, what, 40 years ago, but he, you know, the man's still alive and the victims of the Chilean fascism.
Pinochet?
Yeah, that mm-hmm. putting in this fascist dictator for 20-something years or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, everybody's thinking, oh, yeah, this Congo, you know, Joseph Kony and this, what is this guy? Thomas Lubanga. You know, you go, oh, yeah, those warlords. I mean, they're pikers compared to George Bush. Pikers yeah. compared to Henry Kissinger. And one of it, you know, everybody is armed to the teeth with American weapons, some of it with AK-47s. Right. And there is this 200 countries convened at the United Nations this month, and they're trying to put together a new treaty that would regulate international trade in conventional weapons, like these M14s and AK-47s mm-hmm. and all that. And the effort, which is supported by the Obama administration, guess who's against it? The NRA, the National Rifle Association, because, you know,
because
why?
That's what they do.
That's what they do. The United States is the largest arms exporter in the world, also importer, which is weird.
Murderers, really, yeah. You know, I mean, I hate to be so harsh, people, but it is, you know, we're paying for people to murder other people.
Let's go to Sue in Harrison Township. There are some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Sue, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good.
Good, hi, Sue.
Hi, you know, you were talking about going down to the DIA.
The Detroit Institute of Arts, yeah.
Not everybody's as brave as you, Pete.
Brave.
You know, brave. Yeah, I lived in Detroit 30 years ago, and it's a war zone. It's basically 90% crap.
I go down there all the time.
Yeah, I go down there. I mean,
I go down to Detroit.
You're brave. You're brave people.
Well, we're not brave at all. Let me tell you, Sue. And, you know, actually, when I said my niece was in town, and we had, pardon me, we had breakfast with some of my relatives, and I said we were going down to the Heidelberg Project. Now, the Heidelberg Project is on, which was a German-American district 100 years ago or so. And it's in one of the poorer neighborhoods.
It's in the inner city.
Yeah, it's one of the poorer neighborhoods of Detroit. And one of my relatives said, well, is it safe? And I said, well, yeah, of course. Well, you know, I wouldn't go down there. I wouldn't. And, you know, it's absolutely fine. I mean, going down to Wayne State University, Sue, which is where the Detroit Institute of Arts is and the main library, the Detroit Science Museum and lots of great African American Museum, a lot of great restaurants like Union Street and
what's across the street?
The Majestic.
The Magic Stick.
Magic Stick. Come on. There's nothing brave about that. Really?
I don't know. I just disagree because when I lived there, I did not feel safe at all.
Did you live by yourself?
No. And I lived with dogs too. But, you know, I know this is, you're not going to agree with me, but I think they should move the DIA into the suburbs and have like a beautiful museum, something like the Getty Museum they have out in L.A. I think that would be great.
Well,
they have a
world-class museum right now that's functioning. The only thing is, of course, that like so many other things, pardon me, it is underfunded.
There's a threat of it actually closing. But I think, you know, the more that we take out of the city of Detroit and the more that we stay away from the city of Detroit, the more that it's going to deteriorate.
Yeah, and I think what's important, as I said, is to look at, you know, who we are. You, Sue, could have come with me and my niece and her companion and gone to every single thing. There wouldn't have been the slightest danger.
Fearful moment, right.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, it just is not even an issue. If you live in one of the neighborhoods in the city of Detroit, then, you know, there's a high, because of poverty, always engenders crime. There is an increased risk, a high risk, and I have to be really honest with everyone listening, a risk higher than I'm willing to take at this point. My wife and I lived in Highland Park, which makes Detroit look like Grosse Pointe. And we got broken into a few times. I was doing a lot of
Didn't you get robbed like at gunpoint or something?
Oh, no, I never got robbed at gunpoint.
I know your wife slept with a gun underneath the bed.
Yeah. I mean, because I'd be working here at the Riff doing overnights, and, you know, she's I mean, she had a carbine with a 36-shot banana clip and the safety off.
Which, if you met Peter's wife, you would crack up.
So I said, well, like you, Sue, I said, you know, that I had an option, and I took it. And I know, like the guy next door said, I'm really sorry, you know, I should have been watching your house more and all that. But, and I've said this probably 1,000 times on these different broadcasts. Where I lived in Highland Park, probably anywhere from 95 to 98% of the people were just like you and me, who wanted safe neighborhoods, who cared about their community and cared about their children and the schools and all that. But when you have areas that are poverty-stricken, then you have a percentage, particularly of young men, who say, well, I can't get what I want through ordinary.
I can't eat.
I can't
feed my children. That happens.
Yeah, it does.
They steal to feed their kids or, you know.
Or steal
themselves.
Because they just maybe want just another one of the bangles that they show on television. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I mean, we're shown a successful person is judged by the amount of commodities they have.
Right.
And if you're poor and you have a limited amount of commodities, there's a whole thing. They've done all these studies about a lack of self-esteem. You know, why don't I have a 48-inch plasma TV? Why don't I have a fancy Range Rover like this one that got carjacked? Mm-hmm. You know, why don't I have really all these nice clothing? Well, I don't have a job. You know, I can't even find one. And the ones that are there probably pay $7.25 an hour. And I'm really angry.
What the firefighters are making in Scranton, PA.
Yeah, I can act out this anger and innovate, which is to mean instead of doing it how you're supposed to, by committing crimes. And if 2 to 4% of young men in a community are doing that, the place is an awful place to live. And I think that's what, you know, you and I faced. Hey?
Right. And there's not very good police service.
But why? But you know, and I want to get to David, who's been hanging on a long time, and I'm probably going to have to get to him after the break. But I'm not expecting that you can necessarily answer this, and David, I think, is going to challenge this. If we have the wealthiest country in the world, if we have, like, the head of Apple is making, like, almost $400 million a year, why are we laying off not just where you? I don't know how things are in Harrison Township, but any number of little cities around Detroit and Michigan and all across the country are going bankrupt. Well, I mean, there's something wrong here.
Yep, there is.
Yeah.
Corruption.
Yeah, I blame Bush. That's another story.
Well,
I blame Reagan and
it's Reagan.
A little bit of Clinton, but I blame Bush.
Yeah. All right, so we got to go. So
David, hang on the line.
Yeah.
And also, I wanted to say before we go that we do have open lines. So if you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call at 313-298-9743.
Oh, yeah, and I'll tell you about my trip to London, England, and the Olympics. That isn't.
What?
I'll tell you.
All right.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jalene.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Jalene, did you see this, Hillary Clinton, the U.S. Secretary of State, was in Cairo and got sort of semi-mobbed by this crowd that threw tomatoes at her armored vehicle. Also, shoes. That's a big insult in Arab.
Remember Bush?
That guy,
the journalist, flung a shoe.
At Bush. Missed him, but the insult was there. And didn't somebody, they wanted to buy the shoe for like $20,000 or something? Yeah. But this doesn't say it in this account, but people were chanting at Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Monica, Monica,
no.
Monica.
Oh, no.
That's low.
Oh, that's
rubbing
pretty
it
bad.
In. Monica Lewinsky.
How long ago?
Is she now? All right. I said I was going to go to London. And in fact, a friend of mine is speaking there. And so he tried to see if he could get a little deal for me to speak there as well. And mm-hmm. they said they just didn't have the money because of the Olympic, it's like $1,200 or $1,300.
To fly there.
Yeah. And they were going to, the gallery where this was all taking place was going to actually give me an apartment there during the Olympics.
Well, how about you?
My sister, who is this over-the-top Anglophile, who loves England, who's lived in England, who has lectured in England and stuff like that, she said, Peter, if someone offered me a free ticket to London during the Olympics, that she wouldn't go. She said, it is going to be such a madhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if you saw that these Londoners were PO'd because the British Army put these surface-to-air missiles on top of their apartment building.
Yeah, I did see that. Talk about a little intimidating.
Yeah. And ground-to-air rockets and missiles on the roof of their 15-story housing complex in East London. And they said they filed a lawsuit saying that the missile battery made them a potential target for a terrorist attack and was a breach of their human rights. A high court judge dismissed the suit, saying the government's plans were not susceptible to a sensible challenge.
Yeah. You know what else happened in London recently on a music note is they shut down the Bruce Springsteen and Paul McCartney show because they went past their noise curfew. Like, how do you shut down the boss and Sir Paul? That's just rude.
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely. And they were singing, what was it?
Some kind of
Twist and Shout.
Song? Oh.
No, Twist and Shout.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know that part.
Let's see, folks answering our phones, John and Sarah say, Ed from Harrison Township would like you to elaborate on, quote, crime as a result of poverty. He thinks it's a crock. Well, you know, there are
why don't you call in?
Well, he hung up.
Okay.
But, I want to get all these people on the air. I mean, people see it like as an individual choice. It's an ethical question. Most people don't steal from other people. If you decide to steal from someone, it's an individual ethical choice that you've made, or you have a culture or a subculture of crime. Well, there are great subcultures of crime all over the world. And again, I don't know what to tell you, Ed, although all of them, absolutely all of them, are rooted in poverty.
Yeah, I mean, when people are, well, mostly, I use the desperation angle mostly when I try to talk to people about poverty and crime, because they are truly desperate, and it drives them to do things that they wouldn't do if they, weren't trying to survive.
One of the arguments against that is that 95% of poor people don't commit crimes.
Yes, but, correct.
But, you know, compare that to what percentage of middle class and certainly to upper class people. Well, then you're starting
white-collar crime.
Yeah, well, then you're starting to get into a criminal class when you get into the, 1%. But among middle class people, the crime, particularly the violent crime rate, when you get beyond spousal and child abuse, is fairly low. But when it's such patterned all over the world in every culture imaginable, whether you're dominated, color, region, religion, I don't know what other categories of their human beings there are. It's in the poverty areas that generates cultures of crime, where that becomes the mode of a certain percentage of people that act out a poverty script that includes preying on other people. I mean, why do you think there, all these Mexican crime gangs?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is it because they're Mexican? No, of course not. It's
that's just racist.
You draw this little line in the sand. Everybody north of it is doing okay. Everybody below it is kind of screwed.
Yeah.
So
it always honks me off when someone will say, for example, the 7-Eleven near our houses, Peter,
yeah,
was recently robbed.
Right.
A couple of guys, AK-47.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, and they shot. They shot the whole entire, whatever you call it, where the
big gulp.
Chamber or whatever.
Oh, no.
No. No. And, you know, I was talking to the gal, the lady who works there.
You were in there?
Not. I was in there
today.
Okay,
go ahead. Go ahead. We got it. David, you are next. David has been on the phone for
a while. I'm almost done. See, David, you got to understand, I lost my voice for a week, so I really like talking. Anyway, she said, yeah, a couple of black guys came in, just like that. And I just wanted to slap her.
You know, in this society, I don't think that's unusual for people to identify
that, though.
By race.
I hate
race.
It.
Yeah. I mean, there's implications to it. But
why don't you just say a couple of guys? Why do you even have to say that? You know? Yeah. Unless you're a cop and you need a description of someone.
You have never, and I think, and some of our African-American listeners can comment on that. Someone says a couple of guys did this almost exclusively. People say, were they black or white?
I know.
Yeah.
I just wish it weren't that way.
I wish it wasn't that way. All right, let's have a drum roll
for David
from Detroit. David, thanks for your patience. You get some kind of Guinness Book of World Records award. But go ahead.
Here's David.
Yeah.
Hi, David.
Well, welcome back. I did listen to this show, and you weren't on last week. You're right, so I hope you're feeling better.
Thank you. Much better.
Yeah, and you know, every time I think of George Bush ducking from that shoe, I think of the guy in the little boat in Caddyshack when Roddy Dangerfield's barreling down the river. do you remember that scene?
Yes.
The whites of his eyes as that shoe was coming at him. Anyway, well, you already got my topic, so you already know what I'm wanting to get you to comment on. But to answer what you were talking about earlier with the banksters, I like to refer to them as banksters too.
Sure.
And the confusion about, you know, the ins and outs and not sure what they're talking about with rates and things like that. You really don't have to know it. It's just another way to hide the fact that they're just printing money out of thin air and injecting it into the economy and trying to make it work.
Right.
And the best way that the best person I've ever found to explain this, and you might find it interesting to get him on your show, is a guy named Thomas E. Woods. He wrote a book called Meltdown.
Okay. I've actually heard of the book. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, he explained it to me, and I found it to be very fascinating. But at any rate, yeah, I would like you to comment on that because, you know, with the fact that we've got this ever-expanding government, I don't care if it's, you know, people on the right in charge or people on the left in charge, and then you couple that with the fact that we're trying to print, borrow, and spend our way into prosperity, and you look at, you know, forget the debt clock. I mean, when you factor in compounded interest since we went off the gold standard, and you factor in our future obligations, it's somewhere around $70 trillion that we're in debt. So where are we the richest nation in the world?
Well, I did say there is the greatest amount of wealth in this country. And, the possession of wealth is extraordinary. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's all there. There's wealth. I mean, what's his name? Timothy Cook is not going to be paying back the national debt or, you know, paying down the deficit or anything like that. He's going to just keep getting in hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation as the years roll on. I mean, how many billions of cash on hand does Apple have? Isn't it like 5 billion or 50 billion? I mean, some extraordinary sum. So both is true. I don't know how to really measure it. If I owe you $1,000 and I'm not paying, you know, I've got the $1,000, right?
Not necessarily, but okay. I mean, you haven't paid it.
Well, I mean, if I'm not paying you, the idea is, that there's a certain amount of, what would you call it? Emperor with no clothes on, for sure. And as long as we just keep saying, yeah, we're rolling along and no one says, hey, there's no there. Because like I've always said, I mean, the amount of wealth that exists in the world, the trillions of dollars of value that's measured in, say, bank accounts or in stocks, if someone said, bring all that cash and put it on a table or bring all the gold or whatever tickles you, no one could do it, right? It's not really there. It's sort of a fictional value, if you will.
Well, true in the sense of the type of economy that we have now, a managed, man-made, manipulated economy that features as its foundation, you know, fiat money, money that is non-commensurate with the amount of productivity that the working man produces. So what would happen if you, me, and Jillian were widget producers, okay, and all of the money in the world was predicated upon those widgets that we produced?
Right.
Where would you have inflation?
Well, no, I hear you, but that's not the modern economy, and I don't know where we're going. I don't know how to. I actually wrote an essay one time. I wrote a review of a book on counterfeiting. Mm-hmm. I know you couldn't even do it anymore. This is quite a while ago, and I wrote, "Isn't all money fake?"
Money that's not based on something real and tangible. Okay, and I find it interesting that we go to war with countries whose money is based on something real and tangible, the oil nations.
Yeah.
You know,
it's on the faith and credit of the United States. And I've said before, there's not enough gold and silver in the world to match the trillions of dollars of wealth that people have. So what do we? I don't know what we're going to do.
Well, I mean, you know, you have to remember, and I know you've got to cut me off here, but at one time, actually, this is like the third time in just our nation's history that we went back to, you know, phony money, if you will. I mean, we did it with Washington's Continental Dollar and Lincoln's Greenbacks, and both times the currency imploded and we had to go back to reality. And each time that we did that, you saw inflation come down and you saw the middle class prospering again.
Well, we're not suffering inflation of any particular amount right now, and in fact, there's some people that advocate, one of the ways of erasing debt is to allow in inflation. But you know, I'll tell you, I think this is an important conversation, David, and but I think it leaves most of us befuddled, because all we really want to do is, like I said earlier, it's go to work and get paid, or hire some people and and have them sell enough stuff so we can make a small profit, or a big profit even, whatever. To find economic policy and for all of us to sort through these conflicting claims of the function of money, how it actually has value, what in the world value even is a pretty tough cookie. Because what we know, I mean, you know, right now, I don't know how much money I have in my pocket, $45 or something like that. And it's just pieces of paper, and I know I can go get some groceries or gasoline, or I could almost fill up my tank.
Hey.
But we should continue the conversation, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much, David.
Hey, Jim wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We were talking about the good about Detroit, the bad about Detroit. He said he had his 14-year-old niece from rural North Carolina visiting here last week. He said, took her to see Detroit, went through downtown, the Heidelberg Project, and Belle Isle. She felt safe the entire time. Her dad, his redneck, ultra-conservative brother, was scared stiff and badmouthed every aspect of the ride. Hopefully she learned that not everything about our city is bad. He said he doesn't always agree with us, but enjoys the show. Keep the dialogue going, because talking is the only way we can learn to understand each other. Thanks, Jim.
Indeed, Jim. And David essentially was enunciating a libertarian free market view, and the idea that we have to have a gold standard. That is to say that currency, fiat, that word fiat, not talking about the car.
Right.
That money that is essentially comes off a printing press. That you look at old money and it would say a silver certificate of a dollar bill. Mm-hmm. It meant that before there was a dollars worth of silver held by the United States to back that up, or that they were, I think, I don't know if they said gold certificates or not on them, but that for every dollar that the United States issued, there would be gold in back of it. Mm-hmm. And we went off that a long time ago. Did we go off it? And I'm losing it now. In the 30s or the 70s? Well, yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know whether, but we're not on it. There's very little of the world that is. So.
We were also talking about, the race issue, about poverty, about crime. And Daywan wrote in, he said he agrees. A lot of times he hears people trying to turn crime into purely a racial thing. When I try to explain to them sociology, economical causes,
socioeconomic causes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's what he meant. they still think it's a black racial thing. And he said, and I just heard you say about, were they black or white? I don't understand why people feel the need to differentiate if skin color is not something critical to what I would need to know. Sheesh. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Well, when you have a group in which, in a society, when you have the poorest people have a discernible mark to them, whether they're, I don't know, you know, whether they're from a certain tribe in some countries in Africa, mm-hmm. whether they're from a certain district in Latin America, whether they're a certain race in the U.S., whether, you know, the, and all that. You know, you, it's easy to ascribe that, oh, they're like that. That's
yeah.
what they do.
Yeah.
And it's part of the common, we don't do that. They do that. So it,
right. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah. But like I say, once we have a sector of the population that's scrambling for crumbs at the bottom, you can expect wherever you are in the world that a section of the poorest population is going to be doing lots of things that make the rest of us pretty uncomfortable. But like I said, we loved Robin Hood, right? He used to
yes.
rob from the rich
and give to the poor.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep, indeed. Here is Paul in Sterling Heights. Paul, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, Paul.
I keep it short. I'm a 60-year-old pinko communist hippie type, you know.
Welcome.
I know. Anyhow.
Like you already.
I like confronting the lies. I like asking people, for instance, concerning trickle-down Reaganomics, it's a lie. And the fat cats don't create jobs. You know, it's consumer demand that creates jobs.
Well, yeah, and it's the fat cats, it's the Romney types of the world that have put us in the mess we have, the Bushes, the Reaganomics, mm. all of that, that took the reins off the financial industries, in other words, the regulations, and where these guys are so driven by greed that they'll do everything imaginable to maximize how much income they're getting at the expense of the rest of us. I mean, without a doubt.
Yeah, and without any conscience,
yeah.
you know.
Hey, here's what happened years ago. I mean, 60 years ago, in the 1950s, these auto companies started thinking, why are we paying good middle-class union wages to people here in Detroit when we could be taking these jobs to Alabama and Georgia, places like that, and instead of paying people, I don't know what they were making then, $3.25 an hour, say, we can pay these guys $1.10 an hour. And so they go, wow, yeah, labor costs, save
how much we can make.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, are we going to start fraying Detroit at the edges? Well, I mean, they probably didn't even think about it. But, then, you know, we're talking 50, 60 years ago this begun. And then it was finished off by the Romney types that started thinking, why should we pay people decent wages here in the United States? And we've kind of broken all their unions, and we're not even talking $20-$30 an hour. We're talking about people making $10 and $12 an hour. But you know, if we have this air conditioner made in China or in Vietnam, mm-hmm. we only got to pay them like 90 cents an hour. Or
yeah, who cares about the quality of their life?
Yeah.
Who cares if their kids eat
in that country? And but also, how badly does it screw up? So the 1%. These big corporate geniuses, they're the ones that have destroyed this economy, both in the financial sector and in the manufacturing sector. They are the job killers, eh?
So, here's my point. There's another lie that I like confronting, and that lie is the one that's parroted on, you know, by David Gregory, David Brooks, David from Cokie Roberts. It's everybody on the Sunday pundit shows who, when they hear something bad about conservatives, say, but both sides do it. There's a hashtag you can Google, and the hashtag is Google is both sides do it. And I wish you'd do it just to look at it, because
I'll do it.
This is grassroots, and these people are saying, no,
both sides
don't do it.
Wait a minute, Paul. Is it both sides do it or both sides don't?
Both sides don't do it.
Okay.
One word, hashtag both sides don't do it.
Okay, fair enough. We'll give it a look. And if we like it, we'll put it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/nightcall. If you're Paul, even though you're 60 and a pinko commie,
You may still be on the computer.
You may be on Facebook, so give us a like.
I know a lot of Pinko commies on Facebook.
Do you?
Yeah.
One of our, either John or Sir, or one of our callers said that Britain dropped the gold standard in 1931, and the United States did it in 1933.
Ah.
But what did Nixon do? He did something.
Someone will tell us.
Someone will tell us. I don't even have to think about it or Google it.
Yeah.
Here's Jeff in Redford. Jeff, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Pete, Jolene.
Yes.
Hey, Jolene, I missed you last week.
Aw, thank you. I missed you guys.
Well, I didn't like you before, but, you know, just you not being around, it turned me around.
Really?
So that's
you didn't, why didn't you like me?
You know what? I was just used to having Pete solo.
Well, you know, it's okay. I understand that, but maybe I've grown on you.
It worked.
Listen, I'm sorry to interrupt you guys.
It's like that whole absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Yeah, but I'm sorry to interrupt you guys, but could you maybe let Jeff...
I'm actually hurt that you didn't like me, but I'm glad you do.
Cut it out. No more. Jeff, you wanted to talk about health care?
Well, I had a question about the show, too. Has Nightcall ever been on every night?
Yes, in the 1970s.
That's what I thought.
1972 to 1976.
You settled a bet.
Okay.
I hope it was worth it. A lot of money.
It's against the law of gambling, right?
Oh, yeah.
So anyhow, the health care, you know, I've been working in health care for over 20 years, and I got to tell you, man, it doesn't seem like the government knows what they're doing. And it's frightening to me that they're getting involved.
Why do you say they don't know what they're doing?
Oh gosh, I've seen so many circumstances where people aren't getting the treatments they should have.
This is Medicaid.
Actually, it's Medicare.
Medicare, okay.
And there's all sorts of fraud, and I don't want to get into because it's my particular job and so forth. But just all sorts of foolishness going on, and like I said, it scares me.
Well, you know what, I think, Jeff, is the whole medical system sucks. I mean, there's good care available if you're well-positioned within it, particularly, if you're middle class or above, you get just the best care in the world. Medicare generally gets good marks from the people that get it, but it's, it's not still not adequate enough. You got to, that seniors have to take, if they want Part B, they got to take part of the Social Security and pay for it if they don't have any other funds, which limits their overall income and what have you. And all bureaucratic systems have built within it everything from error to malfeasance to misfeasance and, of course, fraud. In fact, most systems take it for granted that there's going to be a certain percentage of fraud within it. And, in fact, there are some systems that figure out that it is more – this is so bizarre – it is more cost-effective to allow a small percentage of fraud among the recipients than it is to have a lot of investigators, to pay a lot of investigators
really?
To make sure that nobody is cheating out of the small amounts they may be getting. I mean, who they're after and who they really need to get after more are the people that are defrauding Medicare and Medicaid for hundreds of millions of dollars. But we certainly know the private insurance system is so unbelievably
corrupt
and filled with inefficiency, and that so much is spent on bureaucracy and reporting and all of that. And I would hate to think we're in a system where we're damned if we do and damned if we don't, because that's going to leave even more people high and dry. All right, thank you very much. I'm glad we settled your bet, and glad you got a chance to give your opinion. Some lines opening up, 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah.
Here is John. John's in Mount Clemens. Go ahead, you're on the air.
You're on the air?
You're on the air.
Oh, where'd he go?
I think he hit the wrong button.
You can call back. We have open lines.
All right, let's see. I think this is from, from our phone screeners who are saying that the gold standard of that was that for every dollar issued of paper, there had to be gold in back of it. And I said earlier, Britain dropped it in 1931. U.S. did so in 1933. And I said, didn't Nixon do something?
Right.
And then one of our phone screeners, John or Sarah, wrote, Nixon dropped it in 1971. So what is the it? Yeah, because if it was dropped in 33, so remind me. John, you hit the wrong button. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete Joey. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, John. Great.
Good. Hey, a few things. Dave and President Obama need to get off this the deficit, because there's way more problems than that.
What's that? What are they?
The deficit with this country. I mean,
yeah, but what are the other problems that you are addressing?
Well, I'd like to address, I think Republicans refer to it as Obamacare. Well, the first thing is jobs, but let me get to Obamacare. I think the Supreme Court ruling might have been a conspiracy theory. I'll throw that out there.
We've heard that. We've talked
what
about that.
What do you think? What was the conspiracy here?
That they would have overruled the tax or the mandate to pay for it, that Mitt Romney won't have any speaking points against Obamacare.
I've heard that.
Now that they've upheld it, Romney can use it, you know, up to the election, that he's going to overturn it.
What do you think, though, John? Do you think that'll work for him or against him? Because there are so many people that are benefiting from it, even, you know, the smaller aspects of it, like being able to keep your kid on for 26 till 26, you have pre-existing conditions for children, you know, a number of things. So I don't know whether it's working for him or against him.
Well, if people were informed, it would work against them, but I think so many of the American public are misinformed.
Yeah, that's true.
That they believe all the BS is coming out against Obamacare.
Yeah.
And they believe what Romney says against it. And that's why I think that they upheld it, so he could keep going out and, you know, sprouting against it until the election.
I mean,
I think it's absolutely great. I'm in negotiations for my workers for the past 8 years, and by far the biggest expense we have at the table is health care.
Mm-hmm.
So any formula or any new program that addresses health care and tries to reduce the cost, I'm for. But the American public is so misinformed on this that they believe
I think they're confused.
Well, and so, I would say, because, I mean, the lies, the level of lies told by, remember this woman, Sarah Palin?
Oh, God. She opened her big mouth again this weekend.
The death penalty, the death panels, and
God,
and all this other stuff that comes over the internet. I mean, you expect liars to be liars. I mean, who's really responsible for this? And I suspect, I assume when you're, John, you're talking about bargaining, you're talking about union negotiating?
Correct.
Yeah. That usually you guys, through your, either through your international, sometimes through the local, you're giving out the good information. But it really should be through the Democratic Party, and it should have been, I think, President Obama and the Democrats have really been remiss in this, and I think he's starting to pick up, though. I mean, lately he's been defending it big time. He realizes that the independents, the people that don't identify with either party, they say it's a settled issue. Let's move on and start dealing with other things that are confronting us. So, but as I said, I think it's really kind of the responsibility of the Democratic Party to explain this exactly. And like I say, I'm not 100% sure what is going to happen on January 1st, 2014. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's something, and you may want to comment on this. I rarely watch anything with commercials, and usually everything is recorded. My wife records it.
And I don't watch television.
Yeah. But, you know, there's been $150 million already spent on campaign ads, and there's been all this stuff rightly accusing Mitt Romney for the work that he did against this country's jobs while with Bain Capital, and what a scumbag.
Really not going away.
That's not going away. But there's already been $150 million spent on campaign ads in key swing states.
Yep.
A new USA Today Gallup poll of swing state voters find that most of those polled remember seeing campaign ads over the last month. And most voters, 70%, say the ads have simply confirmed their views about the candidates they already held previously.
Yeah, so it's a waste of money. And I'm wondering...
No, it's not. I mean, they got the 30%.
But they're not going to go anywhere. Yeah. I'm curious for people who do watch television, because I don't watch it at all, and you don't watch commercials, if they're seeing these. In Michigan, or
that's what
wherever
I'm thinking,
you are.
Yeah. So far, Obama's negative ads against Romney appear to be working. Among those polled who say the ads have changed their mind, 76% now support Obama compared to just 16% who back Romney.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Romney, I mean, they're accurate. I mean, the kind of, what's the centerpiece of Romney's campaign can't be the one thing he should be proud of, which is Romney Care.
Yeah.
He's running away from that. He says he's going to blow off health care for 30 million Americans, and means you won't be able to insure your kids to 26 and pre-existing conditions.
He is so corrupt to the core. And someone actually wrote in and said that that Romney Care, something pointed out that did include abortion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, while he was governor of the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, and now he's all anti.
Yeah.
It's amazing how they just kind of changed their mind.
Let's see, the Romney campaign discounted the impact of Obama's negative ads. Okay, we're going to take a break. Let's see, Fred in Detroit, John in Ann Arbor, Tom calling all the way from St. Paul, Minnesota. Right. Maybe we'll pick up on him first because he's probably paying the biggest bill. Mm-hmm. And then get to Craig in Birmingham, Michigan, right back after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Hey, thank you very much, and welcome back. It's our final segment. Please participate at that phone number, 313-298-WRIF.
Or on Facebook, or you can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Yeah, I had 1 a.m. Eastern time, which is just in a little while. I'm going to be airing a interview I did earlier this week with Dr. Steffi Woolhandler. She is the co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, and she, from the left, thinks not highly of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, thinking that, among other things, it institutionalizes private insurance, which is not going to be adequate to insure everyone, is not going to deal with the high cost of it. And
did she have anything positive to say about it?
Well, she's glad that it got upheld.
A step,
yeah, yeah.
You know.
That hopefully it is the thin wedge that the conservatives fear.
I like that.
I'm going to have to get this hash mark, both sides don't. You remember Paul was talking
about? Yeah. He gave us the wrong one, but it's both sides don't.
Yeah. I mean.
It's not what he said before.
I don't get it. I went to it. It doesn't.
Okay. We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You can go to it yourself. Let's see. During Nixon, they stopped making coin out of real silver. That was it. Not just gold. Gold is not liquid enough. Silver and gold is what William Jennings Bryan campaigned on. That was in 1898. With his cross of gold speech, he said, "You shall not crucify mankind on a cross of gold." It was a famous speech that he continued to give for the next 30 years.
Oh, man. He needed some new material.
Well, you didn't back then. You didn't back then. People would...
not much changed.
Yeah. People would bring their children to see it because
really?
they had remembered it. You know, William Jennings Bryan kind of got a bad name because he was involved in the Scopes monkey trial.
Yeah.
Remember, there's that famous film with... I can see them both. Anyway, Spencer Tracy and...
Catherine Hepburn?
No. Oh. That was another series. It was about teaching evolution in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot, what was the great act? Frederick March, who played William Jennings Bryan.
Never heard of him.
Really? Okay. Did you watch those old films at all?
I do so. I mean, yeah, sure. Not as much as you do.
Jerry writes, with the corporate money changers at the helm instead of the public, they scam us into feeding their addiction to hoarding wealth. The banks are allowed to loan out 10 times the amount they have on hand. Is there more to this? Let's see. Nope, that was it. Okay, thank you, Jerry, for the information. Phone calls. Let's go back to our phone calls. And also curious whether you're seeing those ads. We'll just go in order. Craig
ads.
From Birmingham. Craig, I was going to go to Tom in St. Paul, but we'll get him next. Craig, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey. Yes, hi, Julian and Peter. How are you tonight?
Good.
Hello.
Yeah, I'd just like to shed some light on things. I prefer to remain somewhat anonymous, but I can speak firsthand from knowledge that And I don't want to say the stereotypical.
Wait, you're a little bit distorted. Can you pull your mouth away from the phone just a little bit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Perfect.
I got you on speaker, but I got my radio turned off.
That's the problem. Okay.
I would just like to say, being a Birmingham resident, that I don't want to speak in general, but I would say the greater majority of the people of Birmingham and Bloomfield Hills, the only way they can really sustain their estates and their well-being is through illegal activity. And I can speak this firsthand knowledge because I am a member of the military and I have suffered a loss of my own personal family due to the system rebelling against me because of my beliefs in becoming and staying above board, if you will, and not participating in illegal activity.
It sounds like the mafia.
Yeah. You know, Craig, don't hate us, but this is way too complicated for the last segment.
Can you email us?
Yeah, email us, and then give me an idea of what. Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
But maybe say, is there one point you want to make?
Yeah. I think he already did. Yeah,
okay.
Okay. Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com because we're running out of time, and this I can tell is complicated. All right, we want to go to Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota, and we should say that the St. Paul Saints, name of a minor league club from the American Association, they're going to change their name for a game sponsored by atheist groups.
I was actually shocked by this.
And they're going to call themselves Mr. Paul Aints.
Isn't
when they
host
funny? The Amarillo Sox on August 10th, the Minnesota Atheists, an American atheist, suggested the promotion to tie in with a regional atheist conference in town that weekend. The game's billing is a night of unbelievable fun.
Atheists have more fun, don't we?
Yeah, the letter S will be covered up, on the Saint sign, so it'll be the Aints.
And that actually kind of has a negative connotation.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And the player jerseys will be auctioned for charity. Saints executive Derek Scherer says the club has no intention of mocking or making fun of anyone's faith. He says several faith-based organizations have sponsored games before and that the Saints felt it would be hypocritical to tell the atheists no.
And it would. Bravo to you, Saints.
And I don't think that's what Tom wanted to talk about, but Tom, hi, you're on the air. Have you heard about that?
I have not heard about that, but just two words. They're looking for a public-funded stadium, so I don't even go to their games.
Oh, okay. like the
Vikings.
The Vikings, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, horrible. Are you familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Well, no, because, yeah. Well, vaguely. Maslow was a psychologist in the 1930s.
Yeah, there's this pyramid where self-actualization is at the top.
Right.
And then there's this broad base of needs, you know, shelter, food, safety.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, you know, learning is like a little farther up the pyramid, and really doing a real good job and reaching your potential is called self-actualization. I think it's a pretty accurate and pretty simple psychological theory. Psychology has a problem that they don't have any kind of simple theories. But these people that are in poverty, they don't have basic safety, basic needs. You know, these people that are sticking up 7-Elevens, they've never gone to the doctor. Okay, there's all kinds of stuff. They're not cared for. They don't have this. And so that's why I think that Medicare for All is a no-brainer. You know, I mean, to think that people have to worry about their basic care.
Yeah, well,
I think that's a really good way to put it. That was good.
I don't know, though. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to be having a tough time figuring that people are committing criminal violent acts because they're not getting health care. But it's part of a matrix of not having the sort of basics of life, and like I said, it's only a rather small percentage of people that actually act that out, but enough. If you're in a poor community and you have 5 or 6% of young men acting out a criminal script,
and some women.
Yeah, they get in the act sometimes.
Did you just told the story earlier about the hair?
Oh, about these four women who ran into this
hair supply though.
Hair salon and stole all this good. You know, it's sort of funny. They had during the 1970s in Italy something called the self-reduction movement.
Okay.
And that was that because of the poverty there, that Italian housewives would go, like 10 or 15 of them. Remember, you know, they're showing this lady, sort of these flash mobs going to these 7-Elevens and just grab everything and kids and run off. I don't know if you've seen that, but that does happen.
No.
But these Italian housewives would go in and, you know, they'd have like 20 of them in with shopping carts and they'd fill everything out and then they would just all run out the door.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, like that. And
How about that?
There they were. All right, what do you think, Tom?
Well, I
self-reduction. Yeah.
I lost my train of thought, but if you don't have water, you know, you can go a couple of days, but then you're going to desperately be doing things to get water.
Yeah, you're going to go a little crazy,
so
too.
You have to have your basic needs met before you can develop, like, your sense of morality. Like, you have a very elevated sense of morality. You get into the real, you know, intricate moral things rather than just the basic Ten Commandments kind of morality.
Well, but yeah,
but the people that don't have their basic needs, they can't reach the potential of having a basic, you know, complete morality that they can stick to because they keep getting thrown back down to, geez, you know, what's wrong with me or I'm hungry or, you know.
I don't know, but Tom, I would think many people would say, as an excuse, I mean, like I say, the vast majority of poor people don't commit crimes, don't prey on their neighbors.
But we don't feel that way.
And that it's an individual ethical choice. I mean, there is something to it, but when it has such such widespread social phenomena across the world, you know it's a characteristic of that particular category of people, no matter what other definition that they have. You know, like race or religion or ethnicity or whatever. So, whatever that tells us. All right, Tom, thanks for calling from so far away.
Yes.
Really appreciate it. And
my mama was born in St. Paul.
Something else. Oh, yeah. And I thought I said that, but thanks, John, as well. The movie about the Scopes monkey trial was called Inherit the Wind. And one of the things.
Oh, well, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, with
and it's
Spencer
been John
Tracy.
All along in there, by the way,
okay.
doing all the research work. And we appreciate that.
Yeah. It was Spencer Tracy and who else did I say?
Frederick March.
March.
Yeah. Still don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the actors, you know, 30. The film was in the 50s, I think, or something like that.
Okay.
Maybe, no, I think actually it made it into the 60s.
So I should see this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. Very, very, and it was, you know, this famous trial where this John Scopes, this Tennessee teacher.
I mean, I know about the trial.
Yeah, he taught evolution and it was against the law in Tennessee.
Maybe I've seen little clips of it or something.
Yeah.
It sounds very
funny. One of the things, though, it reminds me of just recently and how hot it is. It was, you know, one of those hot Tennessee summers and everyone's just sweating and, you know,
I have seen part of this.
Down to their suspenders.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Here is Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Fred, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Welcome back, Jolene.
Thank you, Fred.
Okay, I just had two comments, one about the size of government, other one about the free market. First, I want to say that I don't care as much about the size of government as much as I care about its functionality.
Yeah.
And that, Tea Party concerns in that area are mostly BS.
Yep.
And for Dave, the Libertarian... You know, you have to really decide, do you want more first responders, more FDA, USDA, SEC, and OSHA people on the job watching your back, or do you want more $150 million F-22 fighters, which only benefits contractors?
Thank you.
Well, how much do they cost? Well, then they cost like $135 million a piece?
For one.
How could that be?
I think it's more than that. It may be $140, $150 million. That's high, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you get through with all the maintenance and over-engineering involved.
Right.
Yep. And as far as free market, you know, of course, we keep saying it's not free. And that's for instance, you know, when corporations are running around here in the world buying up water rights from under the poor, you know, that's not free. And when Monsanto is forcing farmers here and around the world to use only their agri products only,
right.
That's not free.
Nope.
So that was basically it.
Yeah, it's another one of those words. It was one of those phrases that they coined to make it sound all happy, happy, joy, joy, but it's the exact opposite, right?
Well, yeah, and the free market's another one of those phrases that the right wing put forward. You'd say, well, you know, what's the opposite of a free market? The difference is a regulated market. And if you have a free market, that allows the banksters, the racketeers, to run the economy. And that's the basis of Reaganomics. That's what sunk us. And that's what Romney wants to repeal. He wants to take more regulations off these people that continue to commit egregious crimes.
Yeah, not even the sort of financial crimes, but, you know, against the environment.
Oh, that, yeah.
Big time.
Oh, who cares about that?
Yeah,
that,
you know.
That, yeah.
I'm not going to be alive when the world falls apart.
Fred, thank you very much, as usual.
Thanks
for calling into 313-298-WRIF. And here's John. John's in Ann Arbor. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. Even though I'm in the yuppie paradise of Ann Arbor, I'm running out of minutes, so I'm glad you took me out of order.
Okay.
We want to mention Clarence Darrow in Inherit the Wind, by the way. I mean, he was the Spencer Tracy role.
I forgot to mention that. The great Clarence Darrow. Yeah.
The great humanitarian indeed. And Alan Haber, who just was just celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement and trying to update it with the Declaration of Global Interdependence as a basis for the United States of Earth. But that's another story. I also did a graduate thesis on the Meso's theory of Yale, of needs at Yale. The bottom line is if the people are hungry and if you haven't satisfied the basic needs, you can't teach them much. But I wanted to do a couple of self-actualizing comments if I could. Oh, by the way, Nixon closed the door. It was in 1965 that we stopped minting silver and coins.
Okay.
It was, in 71, Nixon closed the so-called window on gold, meaning we wouldn't even pay the fat cats of other countries in gold anymore. So he totally terminated the convertibility of the dollar into gold or silver, which was done for citizens in 1933. So that finalized it.
Okay. Yeah, okay, I just saw, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
You and those movies. I'll never get it.
Well, this was about stealing all the money the New York, all the gold in the New York Federal Reserve. But go ahead, John. Sorry.
Dude.
Yeah.
If there's any left there or in Fort Knox for that matter. But another story still. Anyways, another pinko. I want to say, not just hippie, but pantheist. Pantheists have more fun than anarchists, Julene, by the way.
Oh.
Pantheists more than atheists. You've got to recognize that she is everywhere when it comes to God. So might as well recognize God, everyone we meet. Yeah, pantheism is the next step up from atheism.
Yeah.
Just like I've run for Congress on different parties. I want to just say I'm running for the Senate this time on the Natural Law Party, which is wide open, still on the ballot in Michigan. I'll be Debbie Stabenow's loyal opposition. I'm going to throw my votes for it. There's any risk you can lose whatever lunkhead gets the Republican nomination. But we do have open positions still for Congress. If anybody wants to run the Natural Law Party,
Peter,
get another week to get in touch.
Get on it, Peter.
It's a winner. Yeah, get on it, Peter.
He wants me to do it. All right, John, good luck. I got to get another final call. Yeah, John writes in the movie the Inherit the Wind with William Jennings Bryan as Frederick March and Spencer Tracy as the great Clarence Darrow. Great movie, says John. Love Die Hard. Have you ever seen any of those?
I was married to a dude, okay, for a long time who loved those movies. Did I see those? I'm not into it.
Well, can you leave my wife watching them?
No.
Well, you know, in him, Bruce Willis, as he goes along, gets more and more beat up, wounded, dirty, scraped. I mean,
I do recall
that.
They're
a hoot.
I don't know. I like him. I do. It just, I don't know.
He's a right winger.
I don't like him anymore.
Okay. Here's Aaron.
Why would you watch that then?
Here's Aaron and Novi. I didn't pay
for it. All right. Hi, guys. I just wanted to bring up a small point. I was talking with my wife after having come home from, you know, a family function at her house and was like, babe, I was biting my tongue, you know, the whole time I was in there listening to, you know, Republican, you know, verbal vomit.
Are you okay?
And
are you okay?
I made it through.
Good.
But I got home and I was like, honey, your family is not wealthy. Like, why?
Right.
Like, why are they so Republican, basically? And she says, well, they kind of have to be. I'm like, what could that possibly mean? What do you mean they have to be? She goes, the religion. They're against abortion, gay marriage. Like, I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, that's it. I was like, that is, comes down to the point right there. Like, there's so many Republicans because they tie this religion into it.
Yeah. Yeah, they want to. They feel the need to be concerned about what.
Well,
what
I think
do with
that's
their bodies.
It. I think
it's
on
amazing.
The at the economic issue, if you start pushing people that it that they really start saying that both parties are the same when it comes to economics. That they're in fact, we had here an ex someone who just left our employee recently that he said, "Well, let me see, I've got." I got a choice between these corrupt elites who will do nothing for me and these corrupt elites who will give me health care. He didn't have any, you know, health care.
Yeah.
So that was sort of a slam dunk for him. But there's other people here that's that have said to me, I will never vote for anyone who supports abortion. And
yeah, we saw that. That was the lone car in our parking lot with a Romney sticker on it.
A dented neon.
A dented piece of crap neon. And Peter and I went on the warpath trying to figure out who
we
it
did.
Was. We figured it out.
And it was somebody we love.
And we love this person.
Oh, God. It was bite your tongue.
No.
But thanks for that insight, Aaron. Appreciate it. And
Aaron,
I think that is a lot.
I am so sorry you have to deal with that. No one should have to go through that.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a family full of rads. You know,
lucky.
Yeah. I mean, they think, you know, Obama's way too conservative and the health care plan doesn't go far enough.
Yeah.
You know, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're right. It's easier to take if you're.
Well,
that
it's
way.
Not even. It's a non-issue when you have that. You're very fortunate.
Okay, John, thank you so much.
John, thank you.
And we'll do it again next week. Please stay tuned because if you have some questions about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, this answers at least some of it. And then something about, remember that movie? And this fits in. This is an archive edition of the interviews I do. And it's a man that was hired by the healthcare industry to attack Michael Moore's film Sicko.
Oh, right. Yeah,
remember
this
that?
Is a good one.
And he actually got on television and apologized to
yes,
Michael
he
Moore.
Yes, he did.
He tells
and
this
as
story.
Well he should have.
All right, so thanks for listening. Thanks for calling, and we'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call. Right after this.
Thank you very much for joining me. Healthcare. Well, are you confused enough yet? I think most of us are. On June 28th, the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, sometimes known as Obamacare as well. And it provided a number of things that people think are positive. A lot of people have fears about it, though. Is this going to cost me more money? Is this going to actually, solve the problem of that so many tens of millions of people in this country don't have health care or adequate health care coverage if they do have it? I was just on a webinar, remember seminar on the web, though, and telling us about the company's new health plan. I swear, three quarters of couldn't understand what was going on. And also, this has fallen in many ways, at least among the politicians and some of the population as well, into a political issue. So the conservatives think the Affordable Care Act could be just leading us down the road to, to fascism and our choice is gone. Liberals are celebrating this because finally we're beginning to see an opening for having a health care system that will cover anybody. On the other hand, there are people that are on, I guess, and I'll ask our guest whether she feels comfortable assigning this, on the left of center that think this isn't enough, and I certainly place myself there. The physicians for a national health program, and that would be single-payer universal care, essentially Medicare for everybody. And joining me is one of the co-founders of Physicians for a National Health Program. It's Steffi Woolhandler. She's an MD and also has a master's in public health. She's co-founder of the Physicians for a National Health Program. She's a professor at the City University of New York School of Public Health at Hunter College, and she's a visiting professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. She joins us from her office in New York. Steffi Woolhandler, thanks for taking the time out of your day. So you're not one of the ones, or are you? Are you celebrating the fact that this was upheld, the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think it's a good thing that the Supreme Court decided to obey the Constitution rather than play politics. And my lawyer friends say that the bill was always clearly constitutional. So it's good for the Supreme Court to actually follow the Constitution. The bill has some modest benefits. They are indeed modest, but it does improve things for some people. For instance, there's a big expansion of Medicaid by about 15 million. Medicaid's better than no insurance, but it's not a fully adequate coverage. People who have Medicaid know that you often can't get in to see doctors. There's hospitals that don't take Medicaid. So it doesn't really give you full access to care. Nonetheless, that's going to be an improvement over being completely uninsured. My biggest problem with the bill is that at least 26 million Americans uninsured when it's fully implemented. And we know from our research that for about every 1 million people who lack health insurance, there'll be 1,000 people who die as a result. So when we talk about a bill that leaves 26 million Americans uninsured when it's fully implemented, we're talking about 26,000 unnecessary deaths each year due to lack of health insurance. So to me as a physician, 26 million uninsured, 26,000 unnecessary deaths is simply unacceptable.
Well, Dr. Wollhandler, who are the 26 million people? It sounded like it gets the poor people through Medicaid, the poor people of our nation. And, you know, we have the highest number of poor people percentage-wise of any industrial country, and they can be covered under Medicaid. Who is the 26 million?
Well, that's an interesting question. This has been outlined by the Congressional Budget Office. But somewhere around a quarter of them will be undocumented immigrants. But three-quarters of them will be native-born Americans. Many of them are going to find they can't afford insurance despite getting subsidies because the subsidies will be rather puny for people in the middle-income range. Other people who will have incomes just above the subsidy level will find that insurance is way too expensive and it's cheaper for them to just pay the fine under the individual mandate. There's a fine for not having insurance under the individual mandate. So these folks will find it's cheaper to pay the fine than it is to buy very expensive health insurance. So it'll be a minority of undocumented immigrants, a majority of, you know, low to middle income Americans who still can't afford health insurance despite the bill's provisions.
Well, why the big celebration among people who care and within the healthcare industry and people that are politically liberal? It's like we've almost achieved what your group, Physicians for a National Health Program, want. I mean, whereas we haven't. I mean, you just laid that out. Why is there? I mean, there's almost a giddiness that this has passed constitutional muster.
Well, this has become a political football. This style of reform was first introduced by Republican Governor Romney, first passed by Republican Governor Romney. The idea was first introduced by Republican President Richard Nixon. So the idea of a insurance coverage based on an individual mandate was a Republican idea. Initially put forward by Richard Nixon to block the idea of single-payer national health insurance. Single-payer was then being advocated by Senator Kennedy, and single-payer is just another word for an expanded and improved Medicare program. Kind of take the current Medicare, expand it to include all needed services without co-payments and deductibles, expand it to cover everyone from the day they're born to the day they die, and that would be single payer. And, of course, that's not pie in the sky. That's the kind of program that people in Canada, just across the border from where you are in Detroit, have. You know, people get an insurance card the day they're born, like a Social Security card. They take it to any doctor or any hospital. There's no co-payments, no deductibles for covered services, and they're covered for their entire life. You know, that's the coverage that the American people want and deserve, but it's been blocked for decades by the insurance industry that says, no, 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 don't expand Medicare to everyone. Let's do private insurance, and let's pass an individual mandate making it illegal for people to refuse to hand over their money to private health insurance companies.
My guest is Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler. She's a co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. One of your colleagues, Dr. Margaret Flowers, said that it would be pretty easy to have what you're advocating. All you would have to do is take the Medicare Act and drop two words. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly Medicare has the structure of a single payer. It's not as good as a Canadian single-payer system because the Canadian system doesn't have co-payments and deductibles, and it covers everyone. In addition, Canada has not let private insurance companies come in and run what we call Medicare Advantage programs, which is basically taking the taxpayers' money that would go for traditional Medicare and handing it over to private insurance company to run. Now, those Medicare Advantage programs were sold to the American people as, oh, we're going to give you extra benefits under the Advantage programs. What they've done is cherry-picked, so the private insurers go in and cherry-pick the healthiest seniors, collect the full Medicare fee, and run off with huge profits at the expense of the taxpayers. And then they leave a sicker bunch of folks in traditional Medicare, causing a financial crisis for Medicare. So Canada has been has both covered everyone more fully, and they've restricted the involvement of private insurance companies in their program, which, by the way, is called Medicare. So I mostly agree with Dr. Flowers. He obviously is a very thoughtful person, but I think we'd need to make a few more improvements on Medicare beyond just dropping a few words.
Okay, and the two words were over 65, so it would be essentially, as a start, Medicare for everyone. You know, one of the things that I want to do, Dr. Wohlhandler, is just get into what people can expect under the current Affordable Care Act. But let me just have you address this. Here in Detroit, when I do like a phone-in talk show, I often get callers who say, oh, you know, Canadian, everybody comes from Canada to the United States because you got, if you have, you know, if you have some terrible ailment, you got to wait months and, you know, insurance, surgery takes forever. How as a physician and someone who wants a national health program, and you're saying Canada could be one possible model, how would you evaluate their system? I think most of that, by the way, is urban legend, but go ahead.
Yes, well, I'll just suggest your listeners, next time they're in the hospital, look around and see if they find a Canadian
there. I'm going to use that one. That's great.
You know, okay. I worked for years at Massachusetts General Hospital. It's a Harvard's sort of premier referral center. Patients used to fly in from all over the world to get surgery, to get consultation. I don't remember seeing a Canadian there.
Huh.
Now, there may have been one, but I don't remember seeing one. So the Canadians seem to be able to get what they need in Canada. And, indeed, when we look at the health statistics in Canada, they're substantially better than in the United States. Life expectancy in Canada is 2 to 2.5 years longer than it is in the United States. So that just doesn't jive with the myth that there's some major problem in the quality of care in Canada. That's simply not true. Now, it is true that for elective things, things that can wait, you sometimes have to wait in Canada. So if you decide your hip arthritis is getting too painful and you want to get that hip replaced, you may be waiting 8 weeks in Canada, whereas, you know, you could call up tomorrow and find some orthopedic surgeon willing to do it in the United States. I don't agree with waits. I don't think they're convenient. I don't think they're a good idea. But as a doctor, do I think there's a problem waiting 8 weeks for an elective hip replacement? Absolutely not. You know, and when things are needed urgently, like we also replace hips when someone falls and breaks a hip, that happens urgently in Canada just as it would in the United States. Cancer treatment happens urgently. Emergency surgery happens urgently. So, you know, just people who have friends across the border, I should be asking their friends about their experiences there. And I think you'll hear some complaints about the inconvenience of wait, but most Canadians are pretty happy with the quality of care that they're receiving.
Well, I often talk to callers and say, do you ever have any complaints about the private insurance you have? Well, all of us have had problems with that. And, I mean, any bureaucratic system, even at its best, has failings and, I mean, ones that should be addressed. But, Dr. Wohlhandler, let's do this because, and this is my fault on this. Maybe I should even have begun like this in the first place. I think that particularly for people that are uninsured, but also people that are insured, like myself, are probably wondering, I still don't know what's going to happen to me. What's going to happen in 2014? Is it January 1st? And then there's going to be 5,000 people in line at every insurance office? Or what is the administrative procedure that's going to occur here?
Well, we have this plan in effect in Massachusetts where I practiced as a primary care doctor for several decades. And I was there during the implementation of RomneyCare, which, of course, was the model for Obamacare. So we know what happens. Not much for folks with private insurance through their job. The only change is that the individual mandate means that if you have private insurance through your job that's lousy, that you hate your private insurance, you're forced to keep the private insurance. If you're offered private insurance through your job, the mandate says you must keep that insurance no matter how bad it is. You're not eligible to purchase health care on the exchanges. You're not eligible for any subsidies. The big problem that many of us have with private insurance is it's much too skimpy. It's full of gaps like copayments, deductibles, and uncovered services so that when we get sick, we find that our insurance fails us. We buy insurance in good faith, but can still face medical bankruptcy when we get sick. And that problem is not only not fixed by the Obamacare law, it's actually made worse because all of the new coverage offered through the exchanges will be quite skimpy. So the exchanges will be institutionalizing this skimpy coverage that leaves people at risk for medical bankruptcy. And, of course, we can see that in Massachusetts, where medical bankruptcies did not fall after the RomneyCare reform, despite the fact that the number of uninsured fell by about half, which, of course, is what is predicted for Obamacare nationwide.
Steffi Wohlhandler, doctor of medicine and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, is my guest. Please see more at pnhp.org. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. You know, I just, as you talk, Dr. Wohlhandler, I just imagine, I mean, I'm insured and I can feel the my anxiety level raising. I can, you know, people that have not been in, for instance, say somebody listening is 27 years old and they've never even thought about that and they're healthy and they thought, you know how, and they think, like, what do I do? I don't, where do I go? I mean, how do I get this? How do I prove my income? I mean, it does seem like just this bureaucratic morass.
Well, people will probably have access to a website where they can find out about that. That hasn't been a major issue in Massachusetts. What has been a major issue is that despite getting subsidies, people still can't afford care. And then once they get the insurance, despite having insurance, they still can't afford care because of gaps in coverage like copayments and deductibles. So those are the problems. I think the bureaucratic steps to getting oneself coverage, if you can afford the coverage, those will probably sort themselves out for most people.
Well, I was thinking that, for instance, when I just went in for an eye exam, and forgetting about the incredible cost of glasses, but I had to pay a $30 copay, and it was okay for me, but I suspect some people really at the lower rung of income to have to put out $30 is a major problem, to the point where they would probably go, yeah, my vision's not so good, but I guess I can make do. I can still see the, you know, a fuzzy green light up there, right?
Right. Well, this is particularly a problem for people with mild chronic conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol who do have to go in and get treatment on a regular basis to prevent serious complications. But if you have to go in regularly for your diabetes treatment, and you have to take drugs and purchase equipment, it can be those copays and deductibles can be extremely expensive. And people in other countries don't have to deal with that. Things are covered without copayments and deductibles, which is frankly the fair thing to do. You know, it's not fair that someone who has diabetes should be taking hundreds of dollars out of their pocket to pay copays and deductibles, hundreds of dollars every month sometimes out of their pockets to pay copays and deductibles after they've already bought insurance. So the current system is very unfair to anyone with a chronic condition who needs to, you know, use their health care a lot. It's quite unfair, and you know, we can do better. We need to be going for that single-payer system.
I saw some, you know, all these polls all the time. I mean, you within your organization, Physicians for a National Health Program, have lined up some of the more prestigious physicians in the country. Some of who I've interviewed over the years, like for instance, Dr. Quentin DeYoung, who's been on this for a long, long time, calling for single payer universal health care. But I just saw some statistic that 85% of physicians oppose what your organization is advocating.
I haven't seen that statistic. I have seen that a majority of U.S. physicians endorse some form of government-funded national health insurance. In my own state of Massachusetts, the Medical Society did a poll just this year and found the Massachusetts physicians preferring a single-payer to the Romney Care Obamacare reform by 2-1.
Wow.
And, of course, those are the physicians with experience with the Romney Care Obamacare model. So I think doctors like myself are really finding that the way we pay for care is interfering with health care. It's not helping. It's not facilitating. It's interfering, that the paperwork of private insurance gets in the way of good care. And, you know, that paperwork is not just burdensome in terms of physician time. It's extremely expensive. So that the administrative cost of our current insurance system with multiple private insurers, the administrative costs are nearly 31% of total health spending.
Boy.
31 cents on every health dollar is going for just the paperwork or, you know, screen work, if you will, of getting the bill paid. In a single-payer system like Canada, we're talking about maybe 16, 17% administrative costs. Now, the difference between 16% administrative costs in Canada, single-payer costs, and the 31% administrative costs in a private insurance-based system is a huge amount of money, about $400 billion in potential savings if we could achieve the administrative simplicity that they have in Canada. Now, $400 billion is a lot of money.
Sure.
Even in healthcare. It's enough money to cover all of the uninsured and plug the gaps in coverage that insured people like you and I experience. Those administrative savings are the money we need to have a really first-rate healthcare system for everyone.
We only have a couple minutes left, and we haven't talked much about the politics of all of this. The conservatives are very concerned that we're having a loss of freedom to the extent that the governor of Maine said that the affordable health care was a step towards fascism. There was a former spokesman for the Michigan Republican Party said it may be time for armed rebellion. I mean, if you can imagine this, I mean, this is almost on the level of clinical hysteria. Do we suffer either through the act itself or its enforcement through the Internal Revenue Service a loss of freedom in any way?
Oh, absolutely not. And I would agree with you that kind of talk is hysterical. The problem with the Obamacare is not that government has too much of a role, but that the private health insurance industry continues to have too much of a role. In fact, Obamacare is going to take about $460 billion from the taxpayers and hand it over to the private health insurance industry in the form of subsidies for these premiums. And, you know, really that's the problem. And the reason the bill is so flawed is because the private insurance industry was given veto power over the policy decisions in Washington. Corporations now get veto power over any policy that affects them. Now, in fairness to President Obama, he did not create that situation, but he was not very effective in opposing it either. And we've ended up with a kind of compromise bill where there are some modest benefits, but the insurance industry said they'd veto it unless they got this major infusion of new cash from these government subsidies and the individual mandate.
Now, we just have about a minute or two left. It was occurred to me while we were speaking that probably you, Dr. Wollhandler, are covered by insurance. I am. And the people probably that are the most, that don't have it, are the most at risk, often poor people have poor health conditions and what have you. They're also the least politically powerful. Now, you have an organization that does fine work to advocate for a national health program, Physicians for a National Health Program. What can be done? I mean, how can we move towards your goal of a national health program?
Well, poor people are certainly the most suffering, the ones who are suffering the most under the current system. But lots of middle-class people with private insurance like you and me have serious problems with the health care system. In our research on medical bankruptcy, we found that the majority of people facing medical bankruptcy in this country had insurance, usually private insurance, when they first got sick, but were bankrupted anyway by gaps in their coverage. So the healthcare system is working for the 1%, who are making a lot of money out of insurance industry, out of the drug industry. It's not working very well for the 99% of us who work for a living and even those of us who work in professional capacities for a living and find our health insurance is a defective product.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. My guest has been Dr. Steffi Wollhandler, and she is a co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. You can go to pnhp.org. Your health is at stake here, and also very frequently your financial situation. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Dr. Wollhandler, thanks for being on the broadcast.
My pleasure.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. A lot in the news lately about whistleblowing, the big whistleblowing episode of all times, the biggest of all times, probably WikiLeaks. The people in power, the elites, they don't like their inner mechanisms of their decision making made public. They like to do it in stealth. You know, you've heard the expression, right in front of your face, but always behind your back. So there's always a few, there's the one-eyed Jack. There's always an eye that's not being shown. And when we finally get somebody that's going to say, hey, look, here's the way it's really functioning. You thought it was happening like this. Well, there's a whole lot more going on. And I think we owe a lot. We can debate forever about WikiLeaks, but I think some of the more basic elements of day-to-day issues and policy decisions that take place in this country that have been made transparent are incredibly important. Someone who's done that for us is Wendell Potter. He has a new book out called Deadly Spin, an Insurance Company Insider Speaks Out on How Corporate PR is Killing Healthcare and Deceiving Americans. Wendell Potter is a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy and a leading critic of the health insurance industry. You may have seen him on other media outlets. He was leading the campaign to discredit Michael Moore's film Sicko. And this figures a lot in his brand new book, Deadly Spin, published by Bloomsbury Press. It's a pleasure to bring him to our microphones now. He's been on a speaking tour. Wendell Potter, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on, Peter. Thank you.
And we have you in Portland, Oregon right now. You've found incredible interest in your book, haven't you?
Well, I have. It's been very rewarding. In fact, the book was released last month, and it's already in the third printing. So the demand has been significant, and I am on this book tour, and it's the beginning of it, and been very gratified at the way it's been received and reviewed.
You've told your story so many times, so but I think we need to tell it again. You are earning six figures as a PR flack for the healthcare industry. You're working for Cigna, one of the giants, and suddenly, what happened? A bout of conscience, or what? But tell us the story.
Well, it was. I had become increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for the health insurance industry during the last year or so that I was there. I was concerned about the kinds of health benefit plans that the insurance industry is trying to push more and more of us into. These plans feature very high deductibles so that we're paying a lot more for health care out of our own pockets, even as we're making even higher payments in premiums for the health insurance coverage. So we're getting less value and paying more for it. I didn't like that, and I knew that as more people are in these plans, they're often not able to get the care they need. They don't go to the doctor as often as they should in many cases. They don't pick up their medication. So more and more people are winding up in the ranks of the underinsured. I also was learning that the practices of the insurance industry was contributing to the rapidly growing number of people without insurance. Now more than 51 million Americans don't have insurance. But it really took a trip back home. I grew up in Tennessee to just have it in my face, the actual consequences of what my industry has done to our healthcare system. I picked up the local newspaper in Kingsport, Tennessee, which is in northeastern Tennessee where I grew up, and I read about a healthcare expedition across the state line in Virginia, and I borrowed my dad's car. I was very curious. I wanted to drive up there to see it because and said that people were driving from 400 and 500 miles away. Once a year, it's held at the county fairgrounds in Wise County, Virginia. Doctors from throughout the state volunteer their time to treat people. And I was just curious about what it would look like. And I have never had such an awakening in my life as I did when I walked through the fairground gates.
What did you see?
I saw hundreds and hundreds of people who were standing in very long lines waiting to get care. They were in the rain. They were soaking wet in many cases, and these lines stretched out of view. And in many cases, the care was being provided in barns and animal stalls and under open-sided tents. And you could just walk around and see people being treated for one thing or another. I mean, we're not talking about just blood pressure checks here. People were having mammograms. They were having skin cancers removed. They were having teeth pulled. They were having sigmoidoscopies and colonoscopies done. It was just incredible what I saw. It was like a big MASH unit in a war-torn country. In fact, it looked like what I would imagine that to be, either a battlefield where people were injured or in a third world country where people didn't have access to care and they were having to resort to getting care in a barn. It was clear to me when I saw that scene that the industry that I worked for had made it necessary through their practices for people to stand in these long lines in the rain to get care in animal stalls. So I knew then that before too long, I would be leaving my job. I just didn't know exactly how I would do it, what I would do it, and what I would do next.
Well, you got a new assignment, didn't you, Wendell Potter? But here comes all of a sudden Michael Moore, the scourge of the big shots from our own state of Michigan here, who puts out a movie called Sicko, and it indicts the medical system and the health insurance system. Tell me about your role in all that.
Well, the insurance industry was really afraid of Michael Moore and the movie Sicko. We didn't know a lot that was in it. He had kept it close to his vest, exactly what was in the movie. The insurance industry actually sent a young man as a spy over to the Cannes Film Festival in the south of France to be there when it was first screened so that we would know what was in the movie. So based on that information, we began to develop a very expensive and sophisticated PR campaign to discredit Michael Moore and his film, Sicko. If you may remember, if you saw the movie, it was about the health insurance industry and its practices and the fact that even people in this country who do have insurance, often they can't get the care they need because there is some corporate bureaucrat somewhere who says they can't get what they need and what their doctors say they need. And then it also, he went around the world to portray how other healthcare systems have been able to achieve universal coverage for their citizens. Well, the insurance industry was very afraid of that. They were afraid that it might persuade Americans in larger numbers to think that we needed to have a a radical overhaul of our health care system. And the insurance industry didn't want that because it profits unbelievably by the status quo. And so I was part of the effort to help mislead people about the movie and to help attack Michael Moore as an individual and a filmmaker.
My guest is Wendell Potter. He's written Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. And I want to get in more to exactly how Wendell Potter and the insurance industry dealt with Michael Moore's film Sicko. You can go to michaelmoore.com, and he's got lots of information about his film. You can also go to WendellPotter.com. It's Wendell with two L's. And there'll be a link on my website as well, PeterWerby.com. So the film comes out. What does Wendell Potter do? I mean, in fact, describe the effort. Was it like just you, or did you have 20 people? Or, I mean, how massive was the campaign against Sicko by Michael Moore?
Well, it was massive, and it wasn't just me, and it wasn't just Sicko, but it was industry-wide. I mentioned that the industry sent someone to France to see the first screening of it anywhere, but I was given an assignment to fly to Michigan, to Bel Air, where the official U.S. screening was held on June the 16th, 2007. And I went there without disclosing who I was and wanted to see the movie for myself to see exactly how my company was portrayed, Cigna.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the movie with a notepad and took notes, and as soon as it was over, called my office back and gave them some more information about what was in the movie so that we could be more prepared to answer calls from reporters and others when the movie came out. We knew that people would be upset with Cigna and the health insurance industry. So it was important for us to see the movie so that we would know how to develop a campaign to defend the industry's practices and to discredit the movie. So the central thing that we did.
Let me interrupt just a second, Wendell Potter. You were not there by yourself, though, were you?
No, I wasn't. I brought my son along with me.
Yeah.
It was kind of a father and son expedition. We flew from Philadelphia, where we live, to Detroit, rented a car in Detroit, drove all the way up to Bel Air, where Michael Moore has a home or had a home, and his the screening was a benefit for the County Democratic Party. And I had gotten tickets through the Democratic Party, and my son and I went up there. I paid for his expenses. The company paid for mine. He is a film buff and a Michael Moore fan, so I thought he would enjoy seeing the movie and being a part of a premiere. So he went with me. And it was a truly profound experience. I was affected by the movie. I knew when I saw it that Michael Moore got it right. He was very careful, in fact, checking his facts and making sure that his portrayal was accurate. Now, of course, he has a point of view. He, like I do, believes that we really need to have some meaningful change in our healthcare system here. He has some ideas about how it should change and be more like other companies, other countries. So I knew from my own study of those countries' healthcare systems that he got that right too. So I was conflicted, and I knew that my son would see this from different eyes as well. And
well, did he tell me about the relationship here? Did your son know what your intent was? And also, he's an adult, is he? He looked grown up when I saw the photograph.
Yeah, that was in 2007. He was, 3 years ago? He would have been 24.
Okay.
And, yeah, he's an adult. He was in college at the time, and so he... He knew what I did to a certain extent. It's hard to describe, if you're a PR guy, it's sometimes hard to describe exactly what you do. And frankly, there's some things you don't want to tell people that you do. As I have written in the book, I had never disclosed any of that, obviously, when I worked in the health insurance industry. So he didn't know a lot of the dark arts of PR, as I call them, the insurance industry uses to manipulate public opinion to influence public policy. So he knew I worked for Cigna. He knew I was in PR, and he knew that I was there to find out more about the movie and how Cigna was portrayed. But, you know, he didn't know a lot, and I don't think I explained a whole lot about the campaign that was about to start to discredit the movie.
And your son was enthusiastic about the film and asked to have a photograph taken with the three of you, that you, your son, and Michael Moore.
It is true, and there's a picture, I think it may be on my website, that another movie goer who was there snapped a picture of us with me on one side of Michael Moore and my son on the other. And my son also asked him to autograph a poster, which he has and still has on his bedroom wall. But I didn't tell Michael Moore or anyone, for that matter, that I worked for Cigna. Most of the folks who were there were locals, so I'm sure that they knew I was from somewhere else, but no one really quizzed me. But I was a spy, and
yeah,
my son was there on a spy mission with me.
Deadly Spin is the book. Wendell Potter is the author. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show, and Wendell Potter left a 30-year career in public relations, including with Cigna, the health insurance giant, and has been speaking out against the abuses of the healthcare system. Now, you started to say, I cut you off at some point, you were talking about the central focus of Sicko and the impact it had on you, and you undoubtedly understood what effect that would have on your employers and the health industry.
Yeah, one of the things that I did in my job over the years was handle what we called high-profile cases, and often they were called horror stories. We would often be getting calls from reporters or TV producers or radio producers about someone in the local community who had had problems with their health insurance company refusing to pay for some needed treatment. And I did that over many years to the point I was almost numb to it. And so I recognized a lot of the stories, the anecdotes, the vignettes in the movie. I knew they were real because I had handled them, those kinds of things myself over the years. People who were desperate for care but had been denied coverage for care by a corporate bureaucrat who might be a doctor but is just as much of a corporate bureaucrat as I was. So I knew that those stories were real, and the people who were telling those stories were telling true stories about their care. And there were a couple of people who were insured by Cigna. When I got back to my office in Philadelphia, even before I got back, I called in, and there were people who were researching those cases to find out exactly what the company did or did not do, and so that we'd be try to be prepared to handle calls from reporters when they came in.
How'd you do? How did Cigna do in its counter the effect of Michael Moore's Sicko movie?
Well, you know, I think it we weathered the storm pretty good. I think that you know, there were some stories that were negative stories about Cigna and how it had handled certain patients and their care that had been denied for them, or the coverage that had been denied for their care. I remember talking to a reporter with People magazine that had done a feature on one of the people who was insured by Cigna. One of the things that we did, and PR people still do in the insurance industry, is you refuse to talk about individual cases, and you say you cannot do that because of federal laws on privacy, and that's true. But PR people use that as an excuse not to really answer many questions from reporters. So we use that as an excuse for not talking about those particular cases, and then we would talk in generalities about how good the company was and how much the company paid every year in claims and how many people were satisfied with their insurance. And you know, that's true to a certain extent. There's no doubt that insurance companies do good for a lot of people if they are lucky enough to get coverage in the first place.
Sure. Well, was there ever any skullduggery, I mean, any attempt to interfere with distribution of Michael Moore's film Sicko, or anything really underhanded or dirty tricks?
Well, the dirty tricks, I think, were done to try to make people think that the movie was not worth seeing, that it was not factual. And the industry used the PR firm to plant that thought into people's minds, and to get pundits, TV pundits, and to get editorial writers and conservative think tanks to write about the movie and spread misinformation and often outright lies about the healthcare systems abroad. And they also wanted to try to persuade people that Michael Moore was a left-wing nut, and that his ideas were un-American. So that was part of the strategy to depict him as someone who was dangerous to American government and society.
The book is Deadly Spin, and insurance company Insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. Wendell Potter is the author, my guest here on the Peter Werby Show. We just have a few minutes left with him. You can go to WendellPotter.com or my website as well. Well, to some extent it failed. We have something that at least is called healthcare reform. You're now a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. And so you're also the person to ask, how do you evaluate this at least first step? There was certainly a lot of criticisms of it, both from people that are totally dissatisfied it didn't go far enough, and those on the right who say it's this horrible step towards socialism and bureaucracy and death panels. Maybe we ought to leave that. Let's just say that that's not, the latter is not true. How do you respond to the critics, the liberal and left critics that say this is not the Obama administration's health care plan just doesn't do it, even as a first step?
Yeah, well, you know, almost everything that is done legislatively in Washington, that is enacted into law, is compromised to one extent or another. No political party usually gets entirely what it wants. So this certainly was a compromise. I think more of a compromise than Democrats ever thought it would be. They thought, I think, going into this, that it could be a much more far-sweeping piece of legislation than it ultimately turned out to be. And they were hoodwinked, quite frankly, by the special interest in the insurance industry in particular. President Obama campaigned on health care reform, and he said that we needed to have a public option. We needed to have another competitor for private insurance companies that people could choose from if they didn't want to buy from a private insurance company. And he also said he didn't think that Americans should be forced to buy a health insurance product or benefit plan if they couldn't afford it. So he was opposed to the so-called individual mandate that is part of the bill. So the insurance industry wanted two things. They were able to strip out the public option that he and other Democrats said was very important, and they were able to get included in the bill this individual mandate, because the insurance industry loves that. That's the main part of the bill that they wanted to have in there, and it's in there. So it contains a lot that the insurance industry wanted. It also contains things that are good for consumers. It will abolish and make illegal some of their most egregious practices, like canceling people's policies when they get sick just because they want to and because they can. And it prevents them from purging accounts of small businesses when they come up for renewal because someone has gotten sick who is an employee. And it will require them to eliminate the use of pre-existing conditions to deny people coverage. So there's some very, very important consumer protections in the bill. So it's good as far as that goes. It does keep our health care system in place that we've had for all these years. So to call it reform is not really accurate, I don't think. But it's a start, to use a term you use and I've used before. We needed to start to do something.
Mm-hmm.
We've been trying to do this for 100 years, and every single time the special interests have been able to beat it back.
Aren't the congressional Republicans going to do everything in their power to repeal it? That a lot of them got elected on that basis. They're going to repeal Obamacare.
They did, and it was demagoguery. They I guess some of them really think that that's a desirable outcome and something that should be done. I don't say that that's not genuine on some of their parts. But it's not going to happen, because what they will find out when they take office, the insurance company lobbyists will come and have a real talk to them, kind of a come-to-Jesus kind of meeting, and say, look, we gave you a lot of money to help you get elected. Now, here's the way things are going to be. We don't want this bill repealed. You can go ahead and have your hearings in the House. You can castigate it. You can make sure that people don't like it to the point that it can be weakened, and you can strip out some of the consumer protections. But do not repeal this, because it makes people buy our product.
Yeah, a lot more, tens of millions more.
tens of millions more. Yeah. At least 30 million Americans presumably will be brought into coverage with this this bill. If you can't afford to pay the premiums to your private insurance company, the government will subsidize those premiums or give you a tax credit so that you can buy your insurance. So the insurance industry benefits enormously. They will have new customers that they otherwise would not get because people just simply can't afford to buy insurance on their own these days. And they'll be getting revenues that they would not have gotten, and they'll translate that into billions of dollars in profits over the years.
Wendell Potter, let's do this real quickly and bring your visit to Bel Air, Michigan, and the opening of Michael Moore's movie Sicko, and bring it up to date to 2010. I saw the most extraordinary television when you and Michael Moore on a split screen were on Keith Olbermann's show, and you actually apologized to him. Was that that for what you had done as a lobbyist or as a PR guy for Cigna? And was that arranged ahead of time? I mean, was
it came about almost serendipitously? I'm not pronouncing that word correctly.
That's good enough.
I mean, I was asked to be on the show because my book had just come out, and Michael Moore was talking about it because I've got a chapter in there called "The Campaign Against Sicko," and the producers for the show asked me if I would be okay to be on the show with Michael Moore. I was fine with that because I did want to. I did want to apologize for my role. I know that he produced a good quality film that was factually correct. And what I have been doing since I've been speaking out and in this book is somewhat making amends, is telling the truth and the unvarnished truth. I'm not engaged in opinion. I'm not doing anything except telling it like it is and pulling the curtains back. And part of that is essentially making amends, and my apology to Michael Moore was part of that.
Yeah, and Keith Olbermann was uncharacteristically very quiet and just left.
Wasn't he?
The two of you talking.
That was remarkable TV, and I'm almost amazed that I was a part of it, and yeah. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. But he just kind of sat back and let us talk. It was amazing.
We just have less than 60 seconds. What should be done to give us a modern medical system that's worthy of a leading industrial country, at least our country? What do we need real quickly? What should it be?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. What I want us to do is to try to get some of our best minds in a room, and people go into this room, drop their baggage, drop if they represent a big insurance company that's for profit, just forget for the time that they're in that room that they have to satisfy Wall Street's expectations. Look at our country is different from any other country, and try to design a healthcare system that works for all of us. It may not look just like Canada's or the one in France or the UK, but we can do a heck of a lot better if we just put our best American minds in one room and let's say we want to do the best for our citizens.
Well, thank you so much. Wendell Potter has been my guest. He has an extraordinary new book. Everyone should read it to get an idea of the forces that are behind the scenes trying to stop what is best for the American people. The book is called Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. You can go to Wendell Potter's website. Just put .com after his name, WendellPotter.com. There'll be a link at my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And it's published by Bloomsbury Press. Wendell Potter, thank you so much, not just for being on the show, but for writing your book and everything you've done working with the Center for Media and Democracy.
Thank you for having me on the show. I enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.